That was a double wrap, if you didn't notice. Okay, thank you, everyone. If you could please be seated. Thank you. I'll call the meeting to order. This is a special meeting of the House Resources Committee. My name is Tom McKay. I'm chairman of the House Resources Committee, and it's my privilege to be here today with all of you. We are in the Anchorage Legislative Information Office. It's 1 o'clock on Tuesday, November 19th. And I'm going to take a note here on who's present. And we're in the Denali room. We're going to have a meeting today to cover energy issues. And we're scheduled to go from 1 o'clock to 4 o'clock. We have a great deal of information to cover. We have four different presentations. Some are short, some are long. And yes, okay, thank you. And I'd like to welcome members of my committee today. I have with us Representative Wright, Representative McCabe, Representative Mears, Representative Sadler, and Representative Rauscher. And then on Teams, we're supposed to have Representative Baker. I see his name up on the screen. And then we were supposed to have Representative Dibert and Representative Armstrong also by Teams. Representative Baker, can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can, Mr. Chair. It's always good to hear you.
Okay, well I appreciate those warm comments very much. Thank you, Representative Baker. I don't hear that very often. We also have with us Representative Coulomb. Thank you for being here. And we also have Representative Galvin in the audience, I believe. Representative Galvin, she was here. I saw her. And then Representative Foster, Neil, you can join us up here. Representative Galvin and Representative Foster, if you'd like, you're allowed to join us at the table since we have extra spaces. No charge. And we also have several representatives-elect in the audience. I see Representative Costello, Representative Moore, Representative-elect Kopp, and welcome. We're glad to have you here today. If I missed anyone, please let me know.
Underwood.
Jubilee. Oh, I'm sorry. I mixed you up. Representative Underwood, I'm sorry. Apologize about that. Okay, so I would also like to say that we do have a quorum, but it's not necessarily necessary today because we're not going to be taking any votes or taking any actions. Today is an informational presentation. I've already mentioned our guests. I'd like to thank my staff. Chief of Staff Trevor Jepson is over here. And if you need anything, please let Trevor know, and he'll help you out. And then I'd like to remind everyone, please put your cell phones on silent. Okay, without further ado then, we have two items on today's agenda. First, we're going to hear an update on Cook Inlet gas and royalty relief by the Department of Natural Resources and the consulting firm Gaffney Klein. Secondly, we'll hear an update on the Alaska LNG project by the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation and another consulting firm, Wood Mackenzie. They happen to be the consulting firm that conducted the independent third-party review of the AK LNG project economics, which was requested by the legislature via intent language in House Bill 268 last spring, which was the budget bill. So we will entertain the first presentation, the first two presentations on Cook Inlet gas from now till approximately 2:30. We'll take about a 10 or 15 minute break at 2:30, and then we'll do the AK LNG project at about 2:45. I'm afraid that I'll have to really probably limit questions because the slides are quite detailed, and I just encourage members to make note of your questions, and we'll try to get them answered after the meeting or, you know, at some time shortly after the meeting in writing. Okay, so with that, we'll talk about Cook Inlet gas and royalty relief. I'd like to welcome the Department of Natural Resources to come forward, Deputy Commissioner John Crowther, Director of the Division of Oil and Gas, Derek Nottingham, and Commercial Analyst with the Division of Oil and Gas, Weston Nash. So, gentlemen, please state your names and put yourselves on the record and begin your presentation.
Thank you, Chair McKay and members of the committee. John Crowther, Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources, for the record. I'll let my colleagues introduce themselves, but I just would, at the beginning of our presentation, note that we're planning, in light of the full agenda today, to do probably about 30 minutes. Obviously, if the committee has questions, we're happy to respond to them for however long and however many there may be, and then, of course, follow up as necessary. So some of this material you may have seen before, but especially our beginning slides are a bit of a refresher and orientation. So I'll let my colleagues introduce themselves and take it away.
Derek Nottingham, Director of the Division of Oil and Gas, for the record.
Yeah, Weston Nash, Commercial Analyst for Division of Oil and Gas.
Before you start, I'd like to welcome the House Speaker, Kathy Tilton. Speaker Tilton, please, if you'd like to, please join us at the table. We'd love to have you. Thank you. Okay, gentlemen, please proceed.
Thank you, Chair McKay. I know that a lot of this presentation material is a bit of a review from legislative session last spring, so I will try to move through it expeditiously, but feel free to stop me and ask questions. So why is Cook Inlet gas important? The pie chart right there kind of explains that the answer to that question. Cook Inlet gas provides 70% of the electrical and heat power to the state of Alaska. It serves about 500,000 people, mostly in the Anchorage Rail Belt. The pie chart there shows roughly the 60 to 70 BCF of gas that is used every year by the utility and utilities, and how it's broken up. NSTAR uses roughly, they have about 35 BCF of gas under contract. The electrical utilities make up the other 25 to 35 BCF. We're talking about 500,000 people in the state of Alaska who depend on gas flowing every day out of the Cook Inlet to provide heat and electricity. So a very important resource for our state.
And for the committee, John Crowther, for the record, I would just note we talked about this during the last legislative session, but obviously Cook Inlet development involves Cook Inlet oil production as well, which is a feedstock for our in-state fuel usage, jet fuel, gasoline, and other petroleum products. So Cook Inlet development overall, in addition to the natural gas used directly by consumers and utilities, is just an important fuel source for all Alaskans.
That worked.
Okay, well, we made it through one slide. Keep going, guys.
Right. Cook Inlet is a mature oil and gas basin discovered in the 1950s, brought on production in 1958. Swanson River was the first field to produce out of the Cook Inlet area. Recovered about 1.5 billion barrels of oil and 12 trillion cubic feet of gas since that time. That's from 26 different fields, 200 oil and gas leases in the Cook Inlet. There have been 8 or so different companies that are actually producing today from the inlet. There have been more over that period of time. Peak production, we're well past peak production and on decline. Peak production was 850 million cubic feet back in 1990. Today, production is just over 200 million cubic feet. That is roughly the 70 BCF of demand we so often quote when we talk about Cook Inlet. Now, there is, according to the USGSA, quite a lot of resource remaining in the Cook Inlet. When we say resource, we don't necessarily talk about developed economic reserves, but we're talking about the potential for about 14 TCF of conventional gas out there in what's called the Cook Inlet Basin. And if you look at that map up there, that Cook Inlet Basin, as described by the USGS, covers an area well south of Homer up to north of Talkeetna. It's in excess, I believe, of around 5 million acres. It's a huge area. Our leases in the Cook Inlet that the state leases out, I think, is around 2.8 million acres. So maybe about half of that is what we actually lease out. A lot of where this large amount of gas resource is estimated to come from is actually on in the wildlife refuge on federal land. So when we talk about this large resource that's out there, a lot of it is in inaccessible lands or lands that may not be able to be developed, or it's in pools that are so small they can't even be developed economically. So what's an oil and gas lease? It's a tract of land that the state has ownership of the subsurface rights that we can lease out to a potential explorer. When we lease those tracts of land out to explorers, we offer them for a term of 5 to 10 years. A lot of the leases lately have been, say 8 to 10 years. The explorer has the opportunity to come on that land, do some studies, and then hopefully drill a well that finds oil or gas potential. And if they get that oil or gas online within that term, they can hold that lease as long as they can commercially produce the oil or gas from it. If they're not able to do that, that lease expires and it comes back into the state's quiver to be leased out again at some other point. So you'll hear the term unit. What's an oil or gas unit? All of the production from the Cook Inlet comes from what we call oil unit, gas unit. They're basically several leases combined together that encompass maybe a single accumulation or several accumulations that kind of produce together. There's also some surface usage synergies that come into play. And what the unitization does is it allows us to efficiently manage those subsurface and surface resources so that there's not waste, that we maximize the recovery, maximize efficiency of the state and the interested parties' resources. We manage those through an annual plan of development. That plan of development basically states what the operator is going to do in the next year and maybe even to the next few years to further develop the resources on those units. And we can also stipulate things that the state needs to see happen with those units as well. So we can put our own requirements into those. So they are sort of our way of managing the activity to ensure that the resources are getting maximized.
Okay, if I could interrupt you, Derek, just for a moment, I'd like to recognize Representative-elect Melly Jimmy. Did I say that right? Nellie Jimmy, excuse me. Nellie. She's in the second row back there. Thank you for being here. And Representative Mike Kronk is online. Mike, can you hear us all right? And Representative Maxine Dybert has joined us online. Can you both hear us all right?
Yeah, can you guys hear me?
Yes. And Mike Kronk, awesome. Can you hear us all right, Mike? Okay, and Representative-elect Rebecca, Senator-elect.
Representative.
Once you screwed up one, it doesn't matter, right? Sorry. Representative-elect Rebecca Schwanke is also here in the front row. Welcome. Thank you. Okay, please continue, Derek, and we're going to have to kind of get to the whole point here is how much gas is left in Cook Inlet and how much of it can we get to? For instance, at Cosmo, and to help us bridge the gap to get us to the next major fuel source. So please proceed.
Thank you, Representative McKay. For the record, Derek Nottingham again. This really represents some of our lease sale results that we've had in the last year and really the last couple of years. Even with very competitive leasing terms that we've been a bit more, I say, creative to offer out there to try to attract new investment into the Cook Inlet for exploration. We haven't received very many, we haven't received very many bids on leases in the Cook Inlet in the last few years. Three were received in 2024, similar amount, maybe a little bit more the previous year under a net profit sharing mechanism where there is no royalty, but the bidder has to at least bid 5% of net profit share. These are very competitive terms that we've been offering in the last few years with basically only existing operators in the Cook Inlet, and mainly Hillcorp being the primary bidder for the last 2 years.
Okay, let me interrupt you again, Eric. We also have Representative Tomaszewski listening in. And if I failed to recognize Representative-elect Kopp in the audience as well. Okay, sorry about that. Keep coming in. Please proceed.
Thank you, Chair McKay. The graph in front of you really shows the history of production from the Cook Inlet. Most notably there is the peak gas production back in the 1900s. In 1990, 850 million cubic feet and on decline to this day. We're down at around the 200 million cubic feet, which again represents about the 70 BCF of demand that you hear about quite frequently. Of note, the history says that Cook Inlet used to produce over 200,000 barrels of oil a day as well. It is, like Deputy Commissioner Crowther mentioned, significant in terms of historical oil production and oil production to supply the industry in the Cook Inlet as well. This slide shows the history of gas producers and fields for the last 20 to 25 years. On the left, you see the companies that used to be major producers in the Cook Inlet, the ConocoPhillips, Marathon, Unocal, Chevron, they're no longer in the inlet. And as production has declined, Hillcorp has become the dominant producer in the inlet, with a few other small producers adding roughly 10 to 20% of the production. The fields that were big fields and big producers back in 2000, even with the decline, they continue to be kind of the big fields that still produce a lot of the gas that comes out of the inlet today. And other than maybe the kitchen lights unit, there really have been no new discoveries in the last 25 years that have come online and added any significant amount of gas. So that graph on the right, that's really what you can draw from it. It's a mature basin. The gas that we're getting now is coming from fields that we've been producing for quite a long time. This slide really just shows where that gas is coming from, more in a numeric kind of table. Production from gas, production from 2024, the Beluga Field, Kenai Field, the Nilchik, North Cook Inlet Field, those are the big producers. Those are all operated by Hillcorp. Chugach is the majority owner in the Beluga River Field, but that's also operated by Hillcorp. Hillcorp operates roughly 80 to 90% of the production in Cook Inlet. And I will mention oil production from the Cook Inlet has been declining significantly. It's still around 8 or 9,000 barrels of oil a day. It's a significant volume, as mentioned, for the region. So what's happened over time to kind of cause the situation that we're in and get us to where we have a demand that's relatively small in sort of this closed market that exists in the Cook Inlet? Back in the early 2000s, you had the fertilizer plant, LNG exports occurring. As gas prices have increased, those operations have become less economic. Fertilizer plant went offline in the before 2010, 2008 timeframe. LNG exports were done in the kind of mid-2010s, And so prices have increased. Those industries have no longer been able to be viable. And so now what we're left with is kind of the 70 BCF a year that's predominantly heating, utilities, about 10 BCF a year of other industrial sources as well.
So, Derek, there's an important point I think can be made there. If gas prices were lower, we could expect industries to resume, you would logically conclude, right? I mean, makes sense. They shut down because oil, gas prices went up. If we can provide lower cost gas at some point in the future, possibly those industries could come back, and the jobs and the socioeconomic impact of that we would see that.
For the record, Chair McKay, I do believe that, yes, that if there was a lower cost feedstock, lower price gas, then you would see some of these industries come back.
Sure. Okay. Thank you.
I'll talk about gas storage a bit. So gas storage is basically, you hear about it a lot. It is how we manage kind of the seasonality of gas demand in the Anchorage Bowl. A storage facility basically will inject natural gas during the summer in the off-peak season to kind of stow it away for a cold day in the winter, and then they will produce it at rates typically higher than what the actual fields can produce to meet those peak demands in the winter. There are four active gas storage reservoirs facilities in the Cook Inlet right now. You hear about Singsa quite a bit. They are operated by NSTAR. They are owned by NSTAR. They have about 11 BCF of capacity. Recently drilled two new wells this year to kind of shore up some of the capacity and reliability of their storage. Kenai Pool 6 is operated by Hillcorp. It's a massive reservoir. Right now they only operate at about 17.5 BCF of working volume, but it's a massive reservoir capable of taking way more than that 17.5 BCF. And there's two other smaller ones, one at Pretty Creek and one at Swanson River, about 3 BCF. So all in all, right now we're operating in the vicinity of 40 BCF of storage working volume. But like I said, the Kenai Pool 6 facility can take quite a bit more than the current working volume.
So a question for you quickly, Derek. At the end of the last session, we passed House Bill 50, which contained the gas storage bill in it, which expanded our gas storage capacity to some of the properties operated by Hillcorp. And my understanding is Hillcorp has applied for a gas storage permit from, I'm not sure which agency, but is that progressing, that additional storage operated by Hillcorp? I want to congratulate NSTAR. Thank you for the two extra wells at Singsa. That's great. And Mr. Sims is back there, so I want to thank John. Thank you, John. And Mr. Crowther, maybe you can answer that about the Hillcorp gas storage.
Yeah, Chair McKay, for the record, John Crowther, Deputy Commissioner. So in light of those provisions that did pass, we do understand, we can't speak for the private companies involved, but we understand that Hillcorp has been doing an open season to solicit potential interest in storage volumes from potential entities like the utilities. There, they would then anticipate filing with the Regulatory Commission of Alaska, the RCA, to allow storage rates and tariffs to use those fields. The department has modified the leases, which allowed for Hillcorp to do its own storage in those fields to allow for third-party storage. So from a land rights perspective, those fields are ready to go. There would just need to be a commercial agreement with the storage customers and RCA.
Okay, thank you. Derek, I'm not sure we need to cover slide 12 in much detail. Frankly, it's a little bit technical. If you don't mind, maybe go on to 13, if that's okay with you.
Sure, Chair McKay, and I'm going to turn it over to my colleague, Weston.
Okay. Oh, sorry, Weston. I already chopped off your First slide. Nothing personal, guys.
For the record, Weston Nash, Chivola Gas. So the last gas forecast for the cooking that we did was the 2022 cooking forecast. It was the first time in a long time we had done an independent analysis of the gas supply in the cook inlet. And it also does lead into the basis for the Department of Revenue's revenue forecast. In a similar methodology as we do for the oil forecast on the slope, we use a lot of information and production forecasts from the producers, in addition to public data that's available related to costs and plans, such as Hillcorp's stated drilling commitment. And then also the generally accepted petroleum practices for any sort of extra field developments. We do use a standardized set of economics, which is a little tricky in the inlet because we have east, west. You know, the west is a lot more complicated to get to, and then platforms. But with a standardized set of the economic limits, we are comparing apples to apples when we review the volumes or the projected volumes. The primary assumptions we did that we use in the forecast are 15 development wells per year until 2030, and then no new wells after that. We do assume a flat gas price with an inflation, just a small inflation increase throughout the years, but no significant market changes such as LNG import. It also does not include any contributions from non-producing known prospects or speak to the likelihood of their development. So this is just a bit of why we don't, the purpose of this slide is to show why we didn't really include much of the to-be-developed project. This is a hypothetical model for new gas development in the Cook Inlet, an investment of $350 million over 3 years for a 250 BCF production. That is a very, very significant field in the Cook Inlet, and it's most likely going to be an offshore find, which greatly increases the capital expense. So this just shows that the buildup of that developing any new production is, you know, kind of starting at the 1226 per MCF, whereas prices currently are in the $8 to $9. So this is the Cook Inlet gas production forecast that folks have seen. We've added a couple little highlights. One thing to note right off, the heating demand 44, that label is in error. That includes a 10 BCF of production gas usage. So the fields themselves used to produce the rest of the gas. The heating demand itself is the 34.4 or 35 that NSTAR shows being used. This slide is a little bit different than what we have shown. We have shown this is the known and does include the known and undeveloped projects as the green line, and then it shows their gas being used in the future. And we've shown that difference between heating and total gas demand, obviously electric demand. That's what we're showing here. So 2024, this is actually now into a current activity. We did want to show exactly what has happened in 2024. There were actually 20 development wells drilled. I won't list them. You can read which ones they are. But that does include the two wells at Singza and, more interestingly, the two exploratory wells down south. Is that Cosmo?
Next to Cosmo. Do you know the results of those two exploratory wells, gentlemen, by chance?
I don't believe know in detail the results of those, John Grother, for the record, and we'd probably be limited to discuss them until the operator...
Okay. Yeah, and Weston Nash for the record. One well of note is the kitchen lights. Well, that was it's taken a lot of coordination between Hillcorp, Fury, and the state. They have drilled a well, and it is within days of going on production from a report we got from them. So. And then this other pie chart to the side, just showing, kind of reiterating the production slide from before. Updated, well, they both are current with 2024, but again, showing the four major fields and all others equally total up the 28%. And individually, they are all under 10% themselves. In 2024, we also released three seismic surveys. These are the starred seismic surveys in green. So that was the significant amount of seismic data that we'd had on hold. And it's showing there are only two seismic surveys left that are available to be released, that we are working through the process to release those in the future. And then this is just our final slide, and this is the description of current statutes that we are allowed to operate under. And speaking to new leases, existing leases, these are the statutes that allow us to modify any sort of royalty amount. So new leases, no production. The minimum royalty rate is 12.5%, with the potential option of a royalty rate or net profit sharing. We have the option of putting that out there in the sale. This 3805180F45, that was a very limited target bill that applied only to six units when it was introduced in 1998 or passed. Only four fields ever qualified, and no other fields can come in. So as far as mature production that's been online already, there's a single bill that allowed us to modify the royalty for very specific platforms, offshore platforms in the Cook Inlet, and it is very specific to the rate for each of those units. And then the main, our main tool to modify any royalty on future production is the royalty modification statutes, which allow us to modify it to either 5 or 3% based on the specific, there's three specific options we have. And there's a very high bar that the producer has to pass with a lot of information sharing back and forth. It is a month-long process to get any sort of royalty modification for, and that is just irrespective of the size of the field.
Okay, thank you, Weston. Let me ask you a quick question, and then I'm going to ask Representative McCabe to ask his questions really quickly. So a royalty modification by the commissioner of the DNR, if there's a new administration and a new DNR commissioner, can he reverse that royalty reduction or modify it, or, you know, is that subject to change? So you do have some risk of instability. Is that correct or not correct?
Chair McKay, John Crowther for the record. So the authority under AS 3805-180J provides for modifications to the underlying leases through a negotiated new contract, essentially, with the developer and the administration. So there is some durability to a royalty modification that's granted under that statute. It may be subject to limitation or termination by its own terms. So, in the past, the department has granted royalty modification for a set period of time or for a set volume of production. So sometimes there's conditions that cause the end of a royalty modification, but they're not terminable unilaterally or just purely based on a change in policy preference.
Okay, it's been my understanding that if the legislature passed royalty relief, it would be able to withstand policy changes in the legislature and in the governor's office, which would provide more stability for the industry. Is that a true statement?
Chair McKay, I would say that the exercise of the existing authority is subject to the terms in the statute, but obviously the policy preferences of a given administration, legislative enactment that's broadly applicable is, of course, available to all interested parties. So as the conformity of being law, the operators would see that and assess it.
Okay, so Representative McCabe has a couple questions.
So I'm not sure who this is for, maybe Mr. Crowther or Mr. Nottingham. So back on slide 10, you talked about the Cook Inlet gas demand and the users. I didn't see Marathon in there anywhere. Is that because they're insignificant or they're using natural gas for their refining capabilities, right?
Representative McCabe, John Crowther for the record. So Marathon is the petroleum refiner in the Kenai Peninsula is using some natural gas in their operations. I believe they're included in the commercial bar in this chart, and so not specifically indicated, but they are a very critical user. I mean, you know, we're talking about electric generation, heating generation. Similarly, if Alaskans don't have access to fuels that are generated at that refinery, we would have a crisis.
Right.
And so they're a key part of the mix.
Okay, follow up?
Yes, sir.
So Marathon is, they produce fuel for our cars in Alaska. They're the last refinery, I think, maybe one of two left in Alaska.
Representative McCabe, I believe there's three operating refineries in Alaska, but the Marathon Kenai facility is the only one that produces gasoline for vehicle use.
Okay.
It's my understanding.
Okay, Representative McCabe, you're getting three bites at the apple. This is very generous.
So slide 15, I'm curious of the difference between heating and total demand. Is that electrical production? Is that the extra 26 or 25.6 BCF goes to produce electricity?
Representative McCabe, through the chair, but just didn't ask for the record. Yes, that is exactly, that is the electric demand.
That's a scary slide. Thanks.
Well, we have to use candles, Kevin, but I still want heat. Representative Sadler, my favorite question asker.
And very briefly, going back to the question that Chairman McKay asked Deputy Commissioner Crowther, he asked if one commissioner can basically pull the rug out from under royalty relief granted by a previous commissioner. You said that that could happen by operation of the statute, other conditions, but didn't get a clear answer to the question. Can a subsequent commissioner change the royalty relief or end it?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, John Crowther for the record, the royalty relief after formally offered and effectuated by the department is a contractual change between the state and the lessee. So it can't be changed unilaterally by the state. So if in 5 years, you know, if the current commissioner granted royalty relief, it became a contract change, and then a new commissioner couldn't say we're pulling that back. I just would, and apologies if it created confusion, noting that at times in as part of the change granted under the statute, there's a condition or limitation on the royalty relief that causes it to later expire, terminate. But that's not due to just the state having a change in administration and a change in policy.
So I heard a no. Thank you.
Representative Sadler, I'm working on my short answers and it's a work in progress.
Okay. All right, Representative Mears.
Thank you, gentlemen. Through the chair, since this came up on this slide and we're back again, you pointed out a typo on the heating demand that 10 BCF of that is actually for production. Can we talk about that a little bit more? And with declining natural gas production in Cook Inlet, does that number also go down and eventually become zero if production goes to zero?
For the record, Derek Nottingham, through the chair, Representative Mears, that 10 BCF is, a lot of it is used for production of on the facilities themselves. So compressors, they're typically using natural gas to run, to fuel themselves, basically. So there's quite a bit of use of what we call fuel gas in the field. I do believe also that the amount of gas that the Marathon refinery is using as part of that 10 BCF or so. So that's fueling some commercial and industrial operations as well. So that 10 BCF really kind of falls outside of the utility framework, and it's various uses, primarily the two that I mentioned to you just now.
Okay, I want to ask one final question, gentlemen. Which slide would show the proven reserves of gas that are remaining and accessible at Kitchen Lights and Cosmo. Which slide best shows that?
Chair McKay.
Understand my question.
I believe so. John Brother, for the record. Slide 15, the green bars show the known undeveloped reserves. And so that's a volume of gas, I believe, approximately equivalent to 300 BCF. And I would just note for the committee, I don't want to speculate about the specific reserves of operators. They've made public statements. There is public confirmed information available. Bluecrest, the operator of the Cosmopolitan Field, has identified approximately 250 BCF, which is in those green bars.
Yeah.
The Kitchen Lights unit operated by Hex Fury has a contribution to those green bars as well. They have identified 200 to 300 BCF of what they believe is developable gas. That's not fully represented in those green bars, but there are contributions from those volumes, and that's due to the status of the drilling and confirmation of those resources. But so that chart in our general view shows the production from existing and known fields in blue, the known undeveloped in green, and then potentially some of that gas resource going into storage and then coming out in the purple, which shows the demand, the total demand being met until the early 2030s.
So finally, presumably, if Kitchen Lights were to expand their operations and drill more wells, and if Bluecrest was able to develop their gas at Cosmo, we could fill in that gap with those green bars and possibly stretch us out to, well, it looks like maybe 2030. 2031.
Chair McKay, I think that's a fair assessment. And
okay.
Were the Kitchen Lights unit resources to show through development activity more resources, it might even extend a little bit beyond that.
Okay, I'm afraid we have to move on, but Representative McKay, you got one more?
One more thing, yeah. So just to be clear for the public, looking at this chart, in 2028, if we do not get into the known undeveloped, such as Kitchen Lights and others, some way, we are going to be experiencing electrical shortages in lieu of heat in the wintertime, is what it looks like to me.
Representative McCabe, through the chair, were there to not be some contribution of new gas, either these known undeveloped fields or another source, or new energy sources, there would be demand issues starting 2028.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, gentlemen. That's a good kickoff to get us started today, and for the sake of time, then, I'll thank you very much for the presentation. Weston, John, and Derek, thank you very much. And then I'd like to call forward Nicholas Fulford, who's the Senior Director of Gaffney Klein, to give us a presentation on the royalty relief economics. Gaffney Klein is currently under contract with the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee. Nicholas, again, we're trying to get you finished in about 45 minutes, so we'll kind of guide us along that time frame, and I appreciate you being here and your travel, and thank you. And let's see, did we get anybody else join in that I missed? Okay. All right, please proceed, Mr. Fulford.
Okay. Good afternoon, Chair McKay and committee members. For the record, my name is Nicholas Fulford. I'm a senior director at Gaffney Klein. And as Chair McKay has mentioned, we are under contract to the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee. And much of the material presented today was work which was done towards the end of the last legislative session. Back in May, to support the proposals at that time to reduce or remove the royalties on Cook Inlet gas. So the work entailed two things. The first was to start from first principles and create an economic model that reflected the development environment in the Cook Inlet for gas and oil. And the second was to use that model to assess the benefits for a developer of removing or changing those royalties. So before getting into the specifics of the Cook Inlet, I think it's helpful to set out some of the broader developments which are affecting the investment environment in the oil and gas industry globally. So as everyone on the committee, and I'm sure many people watching is aware, the last 4 to 5 years has been an exceptionally turbulent time for the oil and gas industry. There have been quite a number of quite disruptive events which have created a much more difficult investment scenario for developers and backers and financiers. One of the effects you can see here on the slide quite clearly is volatility in price, both for gas and oil. And in effect, what this means is quite significant changes in cash flow, a very difficult environment to predict financial revenues. And the effect of that is that cost of capital goes up, the concerns of investors increases, and as a result, the costs of creating finance for oil and gas go up. Also, I think investors generally are demanding a much higher degree of capital discipline from oil and gas companies and financial performance. And of course, one of the features which kind of hangs over any kind of oil and gas development these days is that of climate policy. And many big lenders, for example, insist on some element of climate mitigation as part of their oil and gas development. And that, too, is causing higher cost and uncertainty. While all this is going on, many other governments, be it state, provincial, or national, are seeking, as you are here, to attract investment to oil and gas jurisdictions. And in general, as we'll hear in the following pages, the challenges of attracting capital to a particular jurisdiction in such a difficult environment are increasing. And we'll go on to talk about that in the next slide. So as I mentioned, the energy demand is continuing to rise. You'll see on the slide, on the graph there on the bottom left, I think certainly in my career, which goes back more than four decades, I can't remember a time where the projection of energy demand contained such a high degree of uncertainty. On the one hand, on this slide, you've got the very high economic growth scenario globally, which drives almost a doubling in energy demand in the next 30 years or so. But on the other hand, you have the net zero scenarios which drive a significant reduction. Part of the effect of that and what you can see illustrated in the slide on in the graph on the right is that investment in oil and gas generally, particularly from the super majors, has reduced over the recent years as these uncertainties have come in. And I think relevant to today's discussion as well, some of these development companies who are investing in projects all over the world, you know, Shell, Eni, BP is three examples, they're all suggesting that their hurdle rates, the kind of rate of return they would expect from their investments in order to approve financial investment decisions have been going up. So now it's not unusual to see a 15 or a 20% IRR hurdle for a fairly conventional oil and gas project, whereas 5 or 7 years ago, that number might have been quite a bit lower. And these are also contributors to the difficulty of attracting investment. With that, I'll move on to the next slide. So as you consider the scope here for royalty changes and so forth, one thing you should be aware of is that all over the world, governments are considering exactly the same difficult trade-off between state revenues from tax and royalty and the ability to attract investment in essential energy infrastructure. On here, you can see that in recent years, quite a number of jurisdictions have introduced quite material changes in their legislative and fiscal arrangements. Norway and Britain are quite relevant in terms of offshore developments, where, you know, again, like the Cook Inlet, we're dealing with very mature basins, mature infrastructure. And so they have implemented some quite material changes. Closer to home, Alberta, Newfoundland, Labrador, BC, they've all implemented changes as well, as well as a host of other initiatives in countries around the world, which you can see represented here. But so this is the background to which people are viewing the Cook Inlet and the mature gas situation, and it's the sort of root cause, if you like, of some of the hesitation that you might have seen in the willingness to put capital forward for future development. The other thing which has been quite a noticeable characteristic of the last few years has been that it's becoming clearer to regulators and legislators that specific oil and gas projects often vary considerably in the economic outlook, in their risk, and that in particular, natural gas projects, and particularly natural gas that's dry, that is pure gas, that doesn't contain condensate or liquids, the economics of those projects these days are particularly challenging. And part of the reason for that is that, you know, with all the developments in unconventional shale gas that you obviously have seen in the lower 48 and globally, the clearing price of natural gas in global markets has dropped below what it used to be in previous years. And as a result, the economics of specific gas developments have suffered. So
we go back, Mr. Fulford. So I think you were kind of focused in on the last bullet here very quickly. I'd like to put that more in terms for the man on the street, if you will. if you're producing a field that produces both gas and oil, for example, that's what that bullet addresses instead of just a pure gas field.
That's correct, Chair McKay. And a good example would be Qatar, for example, the North Sure. in Qatar. It's very rich. The gas flow is a mixture of natural gas and condensate. The value of the condensate is so high that the natural gas is almost a byproduct at very, very low cost. For a dry gas development where no such financial support comes from the liquids, the economics are much more difficult.
So our best example of that might be Point Thompson, because that's a condensate field also, right?
That's correct, Chair McKay, and I know you'll be hearing later on about the LNG project, but
okay.
Obviously one of the major benefits there is the use of gas that's combined with condensate.
Okay, excellent. So let's go to the next slide, and then we'll have a quick break for questions. Okay.
So taking the last few slides into consideration and looking specifically at the Cook Inlet, as well as some of these global concerns and restrictions on capital, there are some particular features of the Cook Inlet which make investment in new gas problematic. One is the increase in cost that's been seen over the last few years, and obviously this affects the whole industry, but it's something which has been seen here in Alaska as well. The infrastructure in the Cook Inlet, obviously some of it goes back to the 60s, so reconfiguring slots on platforms and other features necessary to develop new resources carry a particular risk in terms of cost escalation. access to services is more difficult, you know, access to deepwater ports and so forth is less less easy than in some other jurisdictions. And, of course, there's the significant climate challenges and the environmental considerations. Another feature which is increasing importance in the Cook Inlet, which has been seen in other jurisdictions like the North Sea, is decommissioning liabilities, which can be quite material and which can affect the economics quite a bit. So so those are the sort of core development concerns, but I think it's worth also highlighting some of the unique attributes of Alaska and the Cook Inlet from a market point of view, one of which is that any new gas produced in the Cook Inlet would most likely go to one of a half dozen key buyers. All of those buyers, quite naturally, for prudent reasons, are looking at energy sources other than gas from the Cook Inlet. So that's a kind of a double-edged sword, which also makes it more difficult to ensure long-term secure cash flow from the production. And as we know, for many years, there's been discussion of a gas line from the North Slope. And were that to be built, it would create a very, very different market dynamic in the Anchorage area, which investors in Cook Inlet resources would be concerned about. So at that point, I'll pause for questions.
Okay, Representative McCabe has a question.
On this slide, it says environmental considerations, and on the very first slide, it said investors have demanded better capital discipline.
Let's get back to the right one there, Kevin. They're not numbered, I'm sorry.
Very first one.
The one that says market conditions. Okay, sorry.
It says investors have demanded better capital discipline, improved financial performance, and action on climate change. What would the action on climate change look like? I mean, are we just talking HB 50 with carbon sequestration, giving them an opportunity or a framework to strip their carbon out before they, you know, from what I'm given to understand is people won't even, financiers and venture capitalists and stuff, they won't even finance a project unless there's that type of action from the state, from the legislature.
Yes, thanks for the question. And through the chair, obviously, this is a very complex policy matter which has many, many attributes. But the way I would answer the question, I think, is that many lenders have risk committees and other regulatory constraints which prevent them these days from investing in what I would describe as an unmitigated oil and gas development. However, the banks are also in the business of lending and earning interest on the debt. So many of them, I would say, adopt a more realistic point of view towards climate policy and climate change. And so measures like HB 50, which could enable either in the medium or long term, could enable some kind of decarbonization or element to be introduced, would probably be sufficient to remove many of the sort of basic concerns that lenders might have. You know, obviously, as you all know, the legislature has looked at a range of carbon-related bills and has enacted legislation, all of which helps the broad investment platform for Alaska.
Thanks.
Okay, Representative Sadler has a question.
Sir, are the risks, supply risk and market risk, are those in any particular order? Is that greater to lesser impact or just random?
It's a random list. I would say the biggest ones are the second and third, actually, on that list.
Under supply or under market, or both?
So the biggest risks, I think, are through the chair, establishing a long-term reliable buyer who will continue to support agreed gas price terms to pay for the investment. And the second one is that would require, a very carefully thought out contractual framework, potentially with some measure of state support, which would mitigate against significant price changes were the gas line to be connected up to the Anchorage area.
Got a follow-up, Representative Sadler?
If you were to enumerate the greatest supply risk and the greatest market risk, which would those two be out of those two lists?
I think the greatest supply risk would be the cost pressures. And on the supply side would be securing a long-term gas supply contract with an appropriate buyer.
Don't see that in market risk, but okay.
The reference to gas buyers actively seeking diversification, I think, is the underlying concern. So measures to address that through the chair.
Okay, I think we've kind of set the table that considering royalty relief is not an unusual thing for us to consider based on global activity and market conditions. So let's go on to your next slide then, Mr. Fulford. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Chair McCabe. So on this slide, I don't want to frighten you with the image on the right-hand side, but this is a screenshot from the economic model that was developed. Clearly, the IP associated with this model is has been funded by the state, and therefore this is a model that can be used for future evaluations of different scenarios. So the basis for our analysis contained two different elements, one of which was a new gas development similar to the ones you've heard about from DNR in their presentation. We looked at three scenarios for the new gas development. One was a brand new platform with all the necessary infrastructure put on it. A second involved a development with a tieback to another offshore structure of some sort. And the third involved a tieback to the shore. Now, obviously, those three scenarios carry very different capital requirements. And you'll see that come out in the economics as we go through. The other thing we looked at, albeit fairly briefly, was an incremental gas well option drilled from an existing onshore or offshore location. I won't go into the details of that too much today because, generally speaking, incremental gas well development appeared to have fairly positive economics with or without the royalty relief. But again, these are just based on assumptions that we made. So I think on this slide, what you can see from the tornado diagram on the right is that whilst changes to royalty are sort of broadly comparable to savings in operating expenditure and capital requirements, the two biggest impacts on the economics of a gas development, one is the resource size. It's got down here production, but it's basically the gas that's recoverable from each of the wells and from the facility. And then the last one on the list, which is effectively the largest, is the gas price. For all our economic modeling, we assumed a gas price broadly similar to the existing gas contracts for Cook Inlet gas, around $8.50 per million BTU. But obviously, from the materials that you've just seen from DNR, a much higher price could be required as a break-even to support these newer projects.
So I can't help but stop there and think briefly. So what we're saying here is current gas price Cook Inlet is $8.50 per MCF. So we're saying here, Mr. Fulford, if we didn't change the royalty at all, if we left everything as it is, if OPEX, CAPEX, and production stayed the same, but if prices went up to $12.15 an MCF, then the net present value should go up, and we should see more investment and more drilling. That stands to reason,
Yes, Chair McKay, I think that's a logical conclusion from this slide.
Okay, so right now, let's say it's 850 per MCF of gas produced from the reservoirs in Cook Inlet. If we fall short, we're already having a brownout. Perfect timing. Yes. We want to have like a dramatic effect here. What I'm trying to get at is if we go out and purchase a load of LNG off the international market for, say, $15 MCF, does that affect the gas price that people would pay for the Cook Inlet producers? Does that lift all the boats up to 15? Is that how that works? Or is that – okay, Johnson, so. I guess I'm trying to drive at, you know, if we start importing or from any other source for $15, does that bring this price up on that bottom bar? Is that a good question, or does that not make any sense at all?
This is an excellent question, Chairman Kay, because in a scenario where, for example, LNG imports are required or higher gas prices are required to support the gas line, then a third option, which probably should be investigated in some detail, is if that same price were offered to a Cook Inlet gas developer, whether that would actually facilitate development, whether that would be a short or medium-term effect on the supply of gas to Anchorage remains to be seen. But it would, it seems logical that such a change in gas price would also alter the gas reserve position at Cook Inlet.
So a person could go to a gas producer in Cook Inlet, Hillcorp, Bluecrest, Hex Fury, and say, hey, we're going to start bringing in imported LNG at $15 an MCF. Can you drill some more wells if we pay you $15 per MCF? That would be a good question to ask those guys.
It would be an excellent question, Chair McKay, and I think from the data that you have in front of you and that we've indicated, it seems likely that such a price increase should make a material difference to an investor's perspective on the viability of the Cook Inlet gas.
Okay. Quick question, Representative Sadler.
This may be a little bit deep in a direction that I want to go yet, but so if in that hypothetical scenario that the chairman described, if there was an imported load of LNG, how would that affect the degree to which these other factors, would that enhance the value of Royalty Reef or erode the value of Royalty Reef? I guess I would ask that same question for the OPEX, CAPEX, all those other factors. It's a market disruptor, I know. Just wondering how it play through these factors.
So through the chair, Representative Sadler, I think the sort of relative impact of a royalty relief coupled with a price increase is something we'd have to look at in some detail. It's probably not a simple question to answer, but it's a good question because there would definitely be a trade-off between the two. For example, a lower gas price with royalty relief would result in broadly similar investment criteria than no relief and a higher price.
Thank you. We'll just put it up there.
Okay. I think, Mr. Fulford, looking ahead here, and we have 20 minutes left in this segment, I hate to do this, but we may have to kind of skip some slides and get to the key conclusions, but I'll let you kind of judge how fast you want to go through these, but there's a lot of information on these next four or five.
Yes, I will go through these quickly.
Okay.
And miss out the less relevant ones.
Okay, thank you.
So again, got a slide here with a lot of detail on it, but there are only really two things I'd invite you to look at with this. First is that if you look at the left column and the right column, you'll notice that the difference between a 10-year relief in royalty and a permanent relief is relatively minor in the context of these sorts of investments. And it's partly because, you know, any financial consequences that go beyond about 10 years, by the time you apply a 15% discount rate, they really don't feature. The second is that if you look at the left-hand column with the 10-year relief, or indeed the other one, you'll see that having to support an entire new offshore platform with all the necessary infrastructure on it to deal with the gas production is a very, very challenging project, certainly based on the economics that we put forward. However, if you're able to eliminate quite significant elements of that capital by tying into an adjacent facility or tying into the shore without the need for a new platform, then the economics start to become a lot more attractive. So really, those are the two takeaways from this slide. And I'll now go on and just summarize some of the other features which are relevant to the economics. The first, as I mentioned beforehand, is the size of the resource. So, for example, if you do invest in the offshore platform, then a 500 BCF recoverable gas volume with more wells looks significantly more attractive than the 250. One point on this slide I would note for you and anyone watching is that the y-axis on the right-hand slide is different. They do look rather similar, but the numbers are actually different.
So if I could just make a quick note for the benefit of the committee and the public, but if you could just go back one, Mr. Fulford. My understanding is the Cosmopolitan field is a 230 BCF proven gas field. So that's where Cosmo fits into this model.
That's correct, Chair McKay. Okay. And I haven't seen any of the detailed reserve reports for that possible development, but if ways can be found to increase that recoverable resource, then it would assist the economics quite considerably.
Thank you.
The second feature, which again applies to any dry gas development without the presence of condensates, in most jurisdictions, one of the benefits of a dry gas development is the ability to ramp up or reduce gas production over a very short period of time, so in response to weather changes in heating demand, electricity demand, and so forth. Now, one of the ways in which that's mitigated in the Cook Inlet is through the very considerable amount of gas storage, which helps to even out the gas production from these developments. But even with that, any degree of utilization factor or capacity factor has a very significant effect on the economics of the well. So being able to essentially create an environment where the production is flat and doesn't vary day to day, that again is another quite significant element in improving economics. And then on this third slide, what I've modeled here is an assumption that were a gas line to be built, the value of natural gas in the rail belt region could drop. This scenario is purely speculative. It looks at a potential $1 million, so $1 per MMBTU drop in gas price from 2035. But again, this serves to illustrate that the market disruption and the continuity in gas price and cash flow that before and after a gas line could be material.
Okay, please continue. Please continue.
thank you, Chair McKay. So on this slide, one of the things we were asked to do really during the legislative session, during the last few days of it, was to meet with DNR to make sure that the economic model that we produced was broadly comparable with their assumptions and their development scenarios. We met with DNR, and other than some relatively minor inconsistencies and differences in modeling. I think we concluded that the two approaches arrived at independently were very similar. We did produce a set of reconciled economic results, which are on this slide. This was for the 250 BCF tieback case. And the two scenarios here include a base case, a downside case looking at higher capex, higher opex, and a lower gas utilization. So this gives you a sense of on average, what one of these developments might look like. Okay. So with your permission, Chair McKay, I'll just spend a couple of minutes on the key conclusions. Based on what I've said up till now, you see that a 250 BCF offshore development is a challenging project to secure based on its economics. A tieback to onshore infrastructure would be very beneficial if that could be achieved. But obviously that depends to some extent on collaboration between different ownership entities in the space. The royalty changes would certainly provide a good step up in economics, which might make a difference between a project going ahead or not. But there are other features, including the gas price, higher productivity, and so forth, which would have a bigger effect. And as I've just mentioned, the concerns over what might happen should a gas line be built would also have to be addressed, I think. We were asked at the end of the session what steps might be helpful in terms of facilitating investment in the Cook Inlet. One of the things we would suggest would be the potential for some kind of regulatory action to ensure that infrastructure is being fully utilized. Other jurisdictions have adopted what's typically termed TPA, third-party access mechanisms whereby people can use pipelines infrastructure for a commercial tariff. That might be something to consider. Higher take or pay and potentially higher gas price. And of course, ultimately, you know, all of the costs that we talked about today filter through to the end user. So the ways in which those additional costs are attributed to end users is outside the scope of this study. But nevertheless, it's within the remit of the legislature and a number of state agencies to address that. So I think that more or less concludes my prepared comments. The other slides, I think we can take as read.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Fulford. So a couple points come to mind immediately. In a previous analysis that we saw back during session was royalty relief or royalty reduction results in some millions of dollars less to the Alaska State Treasury. However, the savings to consumers who are heating their homes and turning their lights on is a significant millions greater than the loss to the state. Is that your understanding how this would work? I just want to verify that for the record.
Yes, thank you, Chair McKay. I do believe that directionally that is the conclusion. We didn't, in our study, we haven't looked at the economic cost to the state of supply disruptions and that sort of thing. But I think it would be safe to conclude that there would be an order of magnitude greater than any royalty relief.
Okay, questions from the committee? Wow. Okay, I knew I could count on Representative Sadler.
Kim here. Thank you. Boy, sir, you've given us a lot of information to think about as we consider royalty relief. I support the idea in theory and in general, because I think we need to put some money on the table to try and incentivize production here. My concern of thinking about this is it's in the broad kind of negotiations or posturing between producers and the state. It's up to us. We would set the royalty relief rate first, and then other factors would, the producers and explorers would be able to account for that. But we would not see their whole cards when it came to their CapEx and OpEx and their exploration costs and so forth. However, royalty relief in the grand equation is one of the factors we can control. We cannot control the global price. We cannot control the price of production, price of construction and operation. Royalty rate is something we have a handle on. So, again, we kind of have to make a decision a little bit in the dark, but I think it's one thing we can do. It's incumbent on us to do what we can to engender energy supply for our regions. Yes, we're going to do more work on this.
Representative McCabe.
Thanks. So would it be fair to say, I mean, right now the gas is in the ground, we get no royalty from it. We as a state obviously don't have the ability to go out there and get our buckets of natural gas and bring it into our homes, so we have to depend on somebody to do it. And what we're talking here, and this is more for the public, is we're talking about giving companies a little bit of royalty relief so they will develop our assets and get gas into our hands, which we saw from a previous DNR slide, is going to be an issue by 2028. I mean, does that pretty much sum it up? I mean, the benefit we're going to get from giving royalty relief to a company to develop our oil, or our gas, rather, gas fields in Cook Inlet, is going to outweigh the amount of money that we would put into the treasury if we continue to charge 12.5% or whatever it is. Is that a fair statement?
Yes, Representative McKay, I agree broadly with the statement, and it's worth perhaps highlighting also that royalty relief is a relatively simplistic step that the state can take to improve the economics of gas development. But there are other measures as well the state could either do on its own or with others to improve the situation as well.
Thanks.
So, oh, Representative Mears, please.
Thank you, through the chair. So I'm jumping ahead a little bit because we've got another presentation shortly. But through the chair, it appears our new floor for natural gas is $12 to $14 BCF, whether it be new development in Cook Inlet, whether it be gas pipeline, which we're going to talk about in a little bit, or whether it be imports. Is that a rough assumption that those are all falling in a similar band of cost increase to consumers?
Thank you, Representative Mears, and through the chair. The cost range, or the gas price range that you quoted, is I think broadly in line with where indications suggest it may end up being. But none of the analysis that we've done for this study would enable me to comment in detail.
So I've often said that there's engineers and there's financial analysts and then there's politicians. And, we have to take the economics into account very, very seriously. But we, as politicians, I think we also need to take into account the actual impact on our constituents, and that's where the socioeconomic considerations, in my view, come in very heavily. There's a lot of jobs on the Kenai Peninsula and in the valley that rely on oil and gas operations in Cook Inlet, and if those oil and gas operations in Cook Inlet are to decline or cease, there would be a lot of folks that would lose their livelihoods. So when I think about this situation, I think about more than just the money. I think about how much people are going to have to pay to heat their homes. If you go from $8 to $12, that's a 50% increase. So, that's quite a jump. I know our friends in Fairbanks won't think they won't have much sympathy for us, I'm sure, but I hope they understand my humor on that. But This is an important subject. I think that we always need to remember about all the jobs and all the families and all the people that will be impacted in Cook Inlet if we don't, I think, if the legislature doesn't continue to encourage activity in the inlet to keep those jobs and keep those people employed and keep those mortgages paid, keep those college educations funded, and so on and so forth. So I really appreciate it, Mr. Fulford, your presentation. We'll probably be having more questions and more analysis, but hopefully we won't be paralyzed by analysis. Is there any other questions from the committee or from our guest representatives that are here? No? All right. Well, we're kind of ahead of schedule. I'm doing good. Okay, so well, let's take about a 10-minute break, if possible. Everybody go to the bathroom, get coffee, and we will take a brief at ease for about 10 minutes. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Fulford. If I could bring you back to order, folks. And if I could have the representatives from Wood Mackenzie come to the front table and prepare for. Okay, so I need to make some opening remarks before our next presentation, if you'll all bear with me. So thank you for coming back to order. Remind everyone to silence your cell phones. And we're on schedule, and that's great. So our next subject is an update on the Alaska LNG project. And I should point out, in the spring of 2024, via intent language in the operating budget, which was House Bill 268, the Alaska State Legislature asked for an independent third-party analysis of the economics and viability of the phased approach to constructing the Alaska LNG project. And I will now read the intent language for the record as follows. This was attached to the budget from last session. It is the intent of the legislature that the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation continue to work towards meeting the critical energy needs of Alaskans by advancing a pipeline project proposal which would deliver North Slope natural gas to Alaska's utilities, businesses, and homeowners. Further, it is the intent of the legislature that the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation complete an independent third-party review of a project proposal that would commercialize North Slope Gas and present that analysis to the legislature by December 20th of 2024, which is obviously about 3 weeks from now or 4 weeks from now. It is further intent of the legislature that if analysis shows a positive economic value to the state, all parties would work towards the front-end engineering and design for phase one of a pipeline project. Front-end engineering and design is oftenly referred to as the FEED. This hearing is the first presentation of this independent analysis to the legislature. Wood McKenzie, who is here with us today, and we thank them for their travel to be with us, is the leading global data and analytics solutions provider for renewables, energy, and natural resources. Originally founded in Edinburgh, Scotland, it has over 30 offices worldwide. Their ability to provide independent, thorough, and reliable analysis has led to their success. It is important to recognize the importance the legislature placed on the independent aspect of this analysis. Wood McKenzie will explain to the committee today the information and data they received from the AGDC and independently verified before being used in their analysis. I would now like to welcome Mr. Costa Swift, who is from Australia. He's vice president in the upstream and carbon management consulting team of Wood McKenzie, and Akari Takiguchi from Mexico, right? Managing consultant for Wood McKenzie. So, gentlemen, please introduce yourselves, state your names and affiliations for the record, and please begin your presentation.
Thank you for your kind words. My name is Costa Swift. I'm a vice president at Wood Mackenzie in the upstream carbon management team based in Houston.
Good morning. My name is Akira Takeuchi for the record, and I'm a managing consultant for the gas and LNG team.
You may need to move the mics closer, guys, so we can get them good and loud.
Is this better?
I think so, yeah. You both talk kind of softly, so don't be afraid to boom it out.
No worries. Should I begin?
Yeah, you're good. Thank you.
Perfect. Please keep me on track for timing. I know that that's important. And thank you for the kind words about Wood Mackenzie and who we are. Wood Mackenzie's worked extensively looking at the Alaska oil and gas industry for as long as we have been a practice, and specifically really focused on the issue since 2016. Where we actually performed an economic analysis of the full Alaska LNG project. At the time, my colleague who also worked on this project with us today, David Barrowman, actually came and presented the results of that study. Based on that work, some reworking and some recommendations were made, and those recommendations were we reanalyzed with Alaska Gas Development Corporation, or for Alaska Gas Corporation, in 2021. Since that last study, the AGDC has come up with or a different phase approach, and that's what we're here to review with our independent economic analysis of just that pipeline, or what we're called, or what is called phase one. We value our independence. The work that we have here is our opinion, and it's our independent analysis of it. Any of the information or data that was provided to us, we have verified and are comfortable with those assumptions moving forward. When we looked at this work, we structured the report through five sections, understanding the South Central and Interior Alaska market, what a delivered pipe cost of pipe gas would be, and under that we did scenario analysis based on that. We analysed the cost of LNG imports as the potential other option, and then we did economic impact of the Alaska LNG of phase one and what that would mean to the state of Alaska, and finally our takeaways. So what I'm showing on slide four is two charts. The top chart, I think everyone is aware of the view. That is our Cook Inlet, Wood Mackenzie's Cook Inlet gas production chart. As we've heard earlier in today's session, there is that rapid decline of that production. What we're also showing in that bottom chart there is Wood Mackenzie's and the actual view of the exploration activity that's occurred in the Cook Inlet since 2009. Each bar represents the number of exploration wells drilled. The red line represents a cumulative volume discovered. So what you see, there's been 34 exploration wells drilled in the last 15 years at approximately a 9% success rate with 270 BCF of gas discovered. Now, these discoveries have not been enough to help arrest the decline that we're seeing in Cook Inlet gas production. From a demand perspective, and this is a similar chart that was shown earlier today on slide 5, we have Wood Mackenzie's gas demand that we see in the state of Alaska. As you can see, as that secure, consistent, affordable supply of gas has dwindled, that has led to a demand response with a consistent drop in that gas demand over time, with the fertilizer plant closing, the Kenai LNG plant closing. So you see this continuing in our forecast moving forward.
I'm sorry, can you tell me what just CAGR stands for?
Okay, compound growth interest rate. So it's a 5% annual decline in gas over time.
Okay, glad I asked.
Not a problem. So on slide 6, we're combining those two charts on the left-hand side. So the blue is, again, the gas supply, with the gray line being the gas demand that we have. We've also added the Cook Inlet gas price, and as you've seen and know, that has been rising recently at a 4% CAGR, or compound annual growth rate, over time. And as you see, the difference as it's starting to show in the next few years and moving beyond, you can see a demand gap opening up of equivalent of 2.3 TCF of gas over up until 2070. Yeah. That 2.3 TCF of gas is more than 8 times the amount of volumes that have been discovered in the last 15 years. So for this reason, additional production in the long term from Cook Inlet we have not considered for this analysis. What we have considered is two viable alternatives to Cook Inlet production in the longer term. The first is the natural gas supply via the pipeline, which is a nearly 800 or 765 mile, 42 inch pipeline coming down from the northern fields, connecting to the southern and central Alaska region. And the second we looked at for LNG imports. The first, the gas pipeline, we've assumed a capex of the initial phase one pipeline of $10.8 billion. Now this will raise to 14.9 with if a full Alaska LNG occurs. First gas we've assumed at 2031, and there's the ability in this pipeline at that 42 inch size to cover any incremental size of gas throughput for the Alaska LNG. For the LNG imports, we assume a first gas of 3 to 4 years post-FID. So the project would need to have reach a final investment decision, and then 3 to 4 years after that. We've assumed a capacity for the floating storage and regas facility of about approximately 400 to 450 MMCF a day, with a utilization rate of 40 to 45%. Slide 8 shows our Wood Mackenzie base case. In the assumed, if a pipeline's built, we do see potential for 3 main areas of initial main sources of supply that would not occur in an LNG imported situation. First is the ability for Fairbanks to shift to gas for its energy needs, the Nikiski refinery demand recovering to what it previously were, and if an additional industrial industries occurring as well.
Can you hold, Costa, I got to congratulate you. You're going just the right speed, but maybe it's a little too fast for me to keep up. Can we maybe absorb this slide a little for a couple moments? And did I see a hand? Representative Sadler, question?
Thank you, sir. Through the chair, just for identification of numbers, we have a pipeline. We have 3.3 billion cubic feet per day. And I'm sorry, that's for year. I'm sick. I understand the slide.
Okay, let's settle on slide 8, please. So Fairbanks could shift to gas if we had a pipeline, obviously. And then industrial demand from there.
So
maybe you could go through those bullets just a little more, Costa.
So if you start from the bottom to the top, that dark blue, that's a continual residential demand that we're seeing today. The call it a light blue or purple, that's the commercial use. What you see in that orange, and that's what we've labeled as industrial at this point, that's the Nisky refinery. You can see that getting bumped up in 2031 as the pipeline potentially could come on, that would increase and rebound to approximately 16 MMC of day per day. Nisqually is using other fuels to generate that power. They would switch back to gas under this situation. Then we have the power usage continuing as today. The other two is additional industry demand. You know, we heard earlier today is that if you have a consistent, reliable supply of gas, we've assumed a moderate level of other industrial activity to return. And then on top of that, that last grey bar is the addition of Fairbank switching from its wood and other fuel sources to gas supply in Fairbanks. Now, we would like to point out in the LNG case, those additional upsides of the Nikiski refinery increasing its gas demand, the additional gas, industrial gas and the Fairbanks gas is not included because we don't believe that they would under those circumstances, particularly Fairbanks, just because of the need to build a pipeline.
Okay, Representative McCabe has a question.
I'm interested in, so your source, the number one bullet point down there, talking about Fairbanks. How much effort or how much analysis did you do on, say, regardless of the EPA and the non-attainment area and all of that stuff, is it going to save people in Fairbanks money? I mean, right now their electrical costs are pushing $700 a month. If we were to shift to natural gas and get it a spur line or whatever to Fairbanks so they could burn natural gas and they could generate power from natural gas, would that have an impact financially on the ratepayers in Fairbanks?
So through the chair, we actually have some analysis we'll show later on the price difference, but the analysis we've done, it's not included in this pack, but it was part of the analysis. If you compare the Woodmac case of the gas price that could be delivered to effectively the city gate versus what they are paying at the moment, you know, savings annually for a Fairbanks resident is somewhere between $800 and $1,500 per year just on their fuel costs.
Thank you.
Okay, please continue.
As mentioned, to understand the impact and the economics of the pipeline, we actually ran four scenarios. That base load scenario, which is just the current state of demand that we see in South Central and Interior, the Fairbanks addition, and just the Nikiski refinery coming back online to its previous use. The second scenario is the Woodmac case, which is the same as the base load, plus that additional industrial activity. The third was a high case of consuming industrial plants. So it's the Woodmac case plus a new plant coming online or restarting of the fertilizer plant that used to be here or in a new ammonia plant or a data center. And the last scenario we ran was if a full 20 MTPA LNG facility was run. So it's the Woodmac case plus Alaska LNG coming online. As mentioned by the chair earlier, our numbers were provided numbers were provided by AGDC to us. However, before using any of the assumptions, we did verify them. And the biggest cost is obviously the cost of the pipeline and the building it. So what we're showing here is a benchmark of the pipeline costs that we've seen both what's provided by Alaska LNG, which is highlighted in the red box, and other pipelines that have been built both in the US, North America, and globe. What you can see from this is the pipeline cost, which is $335,000 per inch per mile. It's a bit of a mouthful. Is actually above what we've seen in the average, and it's a reasonable assumption to use moving forward. And that's why we're comfortable using that number.
Costa, where is Mountain Valley and the Coastal Gas Link? They seem to be very expensive.
They are. So if we start with Mountain Valley, that's in the northeast of the U.S. And what we've seen for there, why you had that sort of 570 number, and it's a similar case with the Coastal Link Gas Pipe, which is Canada, BC, is we've seen they're being developed through highly populated areas, and we've seen longer timeframes and regulatory challenges, and that's pushed out the timeline, which has impacted the cost of those projects.
So the Coastal Gas Link in Canada, where does that originate and where does it terminate? You know? I'm thinking Mackenzie Delta to British Columbia, is that?
I would have to get back to you on that.
Okay.
Precise of where it is. It just slipped my mind.
I stumped the experts. How about that? Representative McCabe.
Thanks. So I assume, you know, this slide is an aggregation, if you will, of all of the costs, such as transportation. So is there a way to get a breakdown of how much the transportation for building a pipeline is going to cost? And maybe, and sorry, everybody, self-interest here. What if it went through Port McKenzie and went rail up to Fairbanks, mitigating some of the transportation costs?
When you say transportation costs, are you breaking down that, through the chair, the 10.8 to the cost of trucking of the materials, that lower level of cost? The
right, you get that granular with your analysis on how much transportation of pipe and goods and...
Through the chair, no, not in this case. We've taken a top-down benchmarking approach where we have, and Wood Mackenzie does track, all the major pipelines that are built or underbuilt and build, and we do that on an apples-to-apples basis to ensure that the benchmarks are viable, but we did not build up the costs from the ground up in this situation.
Thanks.
Okay, Representative Sadler has a question.
Sir, you know, the title of the slide says that the 10.8 billion, call it 11 billion round numbers, is well within the range of recently built and proposed. I kind of dispute that. It's the outlier. Other than the Coastal Gas Link, which is also proposed, the AKLNG Phase 1 at 10.8 is the highest cost. I see 1.2, 1.7, 2.2, like a factor of 4 or 5 higher. I'm not quite sure how you say it's well within the range. Please explain that.
It's well within a reasonable assumption to use in this case. It is on the higher side, as you point out, but Alaska and building in Alaska, there are other challenges that other pipelines that we see, the Rover in the US or the Midship or the Rio Bravo, do not have, just the weather and the harsh conditions. So it being slightly higher than that is a reasonable assumption to use, and it's a conservative assumption to use.
I still don't understand how you can say it's well within the range when it's at the high end of the range and is far beyond the median or the average of it.
Yeah, it's above the average and it's at the high end of the range within it.
The range is that red dotted box, right?
That's just highlighting the...
Okay. That's just a highlight. Okay, beg your pardon. Representative Mears.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, I wanted to look a little bit more at that last bullet there about potential cost overruns.
Yes.
That this model includes 20%.
So,
is that typical for potential overruns, or like what are overruns on other comparable projects?
Through the chair, at the pre-FID, at pre-FEED phase that the project is in, having an assumed contingency of 20% is a fairly industry standard when looking at pipeline costs. Obviously, as pipelines move through and develops move through, that contingency probably should lower, but that's something that with more time and engineering, have a better feel from it. At a pre-FEED state, the 20% contingency is what we see from the industry.
One follow-up, please, Representative Mears.
On these projects that we're looking at as comparables, are they at or below 20% cost overruns?
So Mountain Valley and Coastal Gas Link are above the 20% cost overruns. The others, I will have to get back to you exact cost overrun from what was forecast at the time, FID or fee.
Thank you.
So not to auger in on this slide, Costa, I apologize if I don't want to do that, but I'm curious, of these projects, it says some of them are already completed.
Yes.
Some of them are proposed. You may not know offhand. I guess I'm curious which ones are completed and which ones are at FID, the final investment decision? And you may not know that at this time. I guess I'm trying to compare our project where we're in the midst of developing the feed. So, you know, where are we in compared to those others on the timeline? And you may not know that.
Not a problem. So the ones that are in italics are still not built and operating.
Oh, okay.
So what that means is on this chart, Alaska LNG Pipeline, Louisiana Connector, Coastal Gas Link, are the ones that are not built and operating. All the others, so Mountain Valley, Midship, Rio Bravo, Rover, Gulf Run, AKK Pipeline, GPNK Phase 1, Nova Era Pipeline are all operating. So these are actual costs that will not change. The others that are building, there's room for change moving forward because they haven't been completed.
Okay, very good. We do have a question from one of our representatives that's online. Representative Dibert, you have a question? Representative Dibert?
Yeah, hi, Chairman Kay. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Please go ahead with your question.
Yes, this is Representative Dibert from Fairbanks. So I have a Fairbanks question. On scenario one, is the cost of the Fairbanks spur included in the projected cost that were used for the viability study?
No, through the chair, no, the cost of the spur wasn't included in the analysis.
So I assume an outside investor would be needed to build that spur, and whoever that is going to want to charge the gas coming to Fairbanks, and that price would clearly be passed on to Fairbanks consumers.
Through the chair, we would assume that any spur would have to be paid for and a tariff would be involved in that spur cost.
How many miles is Fairbanks from the TAPS corridor? Does anybody know offhand? 32 miles. Okay, so the answer is 32 miles of spur line would be needed.
Follow up?
32 miles, Representative Dibert, from Fairbanks to TAPS. So, and I think it's all fairly flat. I don't think there's any mountain ranges to cross. So seems like that could be a fairly straightforward project, 32 miles of spur to get from the TAPS corridor over to Fairbanks. Okay. Representative Dibert, does that answer your question?
Yeah, thank you, Chair McKay. And just one quick follow-up on that 30-mile. Through the chair, do you know if that the permitting for that line has already been completed? Is the permitting for a Fairbanks takeoff spur already completed and paid for? Because I know the line, all the permits have gone through. Has that been looked at? Thank you. Through the chair.
That's a good question. Our presenters may not know the answer to that. Is there anybody in the room that knows the answer to that? Mr. Richards, please, quickly. Or Nick? Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Frank Richards, the spur line, again, is there's an offtake point on near the Chattanooga River on the Alaska LNG pipeline corridor, and the route goes up and over Murphy Dome, so it's approximately 32 miles. The cost estimate was about $180 million. And when we look at the tariff estimates, and that adds approximately 80 cents that would be charged for the gas flowing from the main line into the city gate.
And the permits? Any permits?
Permits. So this, the actual Fairbanks lateral was designed to a feed level of effort by AGDC, and the permitting process went forward under the Army Corps of Engineers when we were looking at the in-state project called the Alaska Standalone Pipeline Project. Now those permits were put on hold, and we were given the responsibility and the direction to advance the Alaska LNG project. So a lot of the legwork has been done, and we need to then re-up those permits.
Okay. Representative Dibert, did you hear that okay?
Thank you, through the chair. Thank you, Mr. Richards.
Okay.
And no more questions. Thank you.
What did you say, one more question or no more questions?
No more questions.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Dybert. Always good to hear from you. Okay, let's continue, gentlemen. Thank you.
So moving to slide 11, what we show here is the four cases that we talked about across the top, the base case, the WoodMac case, the additional industrial case, and the Alaska LNG case. And then what we show is the additional CapEx for each of the cases. So we have the mainline, the $10.8 billion we've spoke about. Then if an Alaska LNG situation was to occur, or the project would go ahead, there would be additional CapEx required for that. So compression, nearly $2.5 billion, additional sections across the Cook Inlet of approximately $1 billion, and Point Thompson expansion of another $500 million. So that would take the total project cost of somewhere close to over $14 billion. What we'd like to point out, and in this analysis, is that additional cost of the compression, Cook Inlet, and the additional section will not be, we have not burdened that cost to the domestic market. That cost in our modelling and our economic analysis will be burdened by the Alaska LNG full project itself.
So this assumes the origination of the line would be at Prudhoe Bay.
Yes.
And the offtake would be Prudhoe Bay gas.
It assumes Great Bear Pantheon gas initially.
Okay. Oh, okay. All right. Glad I asked that then. All right. Okay. Representative Sadler.
To that point, that kind of tweaked me when I read these slides earlier. This presumes that Pantheon Great Bear would supply all the gas for how long? Say, initially, how long?
So it's assumed that they'll supply the in-state demand, through the chair, apologies, would be able to supply the gas through the life for the domestic or the in-state demand through the life of the analysis that we have completed.
For just the first case?
So. For the first case.
Gotcha.
What we have done is Wood Mackenzie models the upstream fields based on the early results of the test that's been made publicly available. Our analysts completed a low side, a base case, and a high case for what the development could look like. We ran that economic model under a situation where they do not sell the gas under all three, and a situation where the gas is sold at the $1 price, which we'll talk about in the assumptions. And it made economic sense under all three cases for Great Pantheon to sell the gas at $1 to the pipeline. And therefore, that's how we verified that's a reasonable assumption for it to do. It's NPV positive for the development to sell the gas at $1.
Okay, please continue, Costa.
What we show on slide 12 is a visual representation of the four throughput scenarios. So working up from the base load all the way up to Alaska LNG in that yellow color. The next shows the range of CapEx from 10.8 up to $14.3 billion. What I would like to draw your attention to is the delivered cost of gas on the right-hand side. So this is the Citygate gas price under each scenario, ensuring a 10% return on equity to the pipeline developer. What tariff would you need under that throughput scenario to guarantee that return? So under the base load, $12.80. Under the WoodMac case, $11.20. Moving to the additional demand of $8.97, all the way down to $2.23 if the full Alaska LNG project was to come on. What this shows is the asymmetrical nature of the delivered cost of gas. The more demand means the more throughput, means less revenue is needed on each molecule through the pipeline to return that 10% return to the pipeline developer. Therefore, the tariff price comes down. That delivered cost of gas is also that $1 per MMBTU we talked about, plus the tariff charge required to meet the 10% return.
So if I may just sort of, I like to kind of simplify things for the folks back home, as they say. If we were up and running full capacity, Alaska LNG, we could see a gas price in South Central of $2.23, which is like a quarter of what we're paying right now. Is that?
Yes, that's what our analysis shows. If the pipe is full through and the full capacity is used for Alaska LNG with a $1 purchase price of the gas at the inlet, that you'd only need to pay on top of that $1.23 to ensure the returns. Therefore, the cost of gas would be $2.23.
And then just by comparison, in the green box at $8.97 is roughly what we're paying now at $8.50,
I believe.
Roughly. Okay. Representative Sadler?
It'd be a downer, but we just heard the Gaffney Klein folks, the market uncertainties and other factors are requiring majors to require a 15 to 20% rate of return, and you're modeling a 10%. So much as I'd like to be able to rely on these, want to run those with numbers, or actually I should ask the question, how would you reconcile what we heard from Gaffney Klein about the higher rates of return required for investment in large gas projects?
There's it's a very difficult question when it comes to hurdle rates and investment decisions each company's face under a current environment. There's also, it's not just oil and gas hurdle rates are increasing across the board. It's also the type of investment. What you do see in through a life cycle of an asset and the type of asset, an upstream return does tend to be higher because there is more uncertainty with the forecast of production, cost and price. What we do see in an infrastructure situation, which is what this pipeline is, you have more certainty of the gas coming in and the contracted price coming out. Therefore, we do see a lower hurdle rate used, and we assume a 10% rate in that situation is a reasonable assumption.
Okay. Kevin, you have your finger was pointing at me. Okay, please continue, Costa. Thank you.
Not a problem. On slide 13, what we also did was not just run the base case. We ran sensitivities on some of the key factors that could impact the gas price. So everything from the assumed debt-to-equity ratio of 75-25 to the cost of debt to the return on the equity required, the life of the project, the cost of the gas, the capex, and using an alternative supply. What you do see is the property tax income, property tax from 2 to 0.2% as a large impact on the cost of gas. The other is a potential and the cost of debt to finance the project.
Okay, let's hold here a minute, because there's a lot of information here to absorb. So my understanding is the Great Bear Pantheon gas has a really low CO2 content.
Yes.
Which is good.
Yes.
Don't have to scrub out the CO2. And I also understand that Point Thompson gas is also fairly low, I think around 4% CO2, Point Thompson. But the Prudhoe Bay gas, I think, is around 10% CO2. So if we ever got to the point where we need to bring Prudhoe gas down the pipeline, we'd have to discuss removing the CO2 before it was shipped, is my understanding. Maybe I'm getting a little bit off subject, but.
No, based on what you have said, yes, there would be additional capex required to bring that gas up to pipeline spec.
Yeah, that's what pipeline spec. Okay. Did you do any? Kevin has a question. I'll let Kevin McCabe, please, represent McCabe.
You just said additional CapEx to bring it up to spec. What specifically are you talking about, the Title VI wells for sequestration to put the CO2 somewhere, or what kind of CapEx are we talking?
There would be CapEx at the processing plant to strip it out, and then there would be CapEx related to how you handle the CO2 once it's stripped out.
Okay, thanks.
So I'm not sure when to ask this question, so I'm just going to let it rip. Right now, it's my understanding that Japan and possibly Korea and Asian customers are purchasing a tanker load per day of LNG coming off of the Siberian Russia northern coast. One tanker per day going through the Bering Straits every day while we're sitting here, you know, basically analyzing what we might do. If the federal government subsidize this project with X amount of billions of dollars because it's a national imperative, which could happen under our new president in January. What would that do to your evaluation? Is that a fair question, Costa? Do you understand what I'm asking?
So through the chair, let me just replay the question to make sure I understand. What if the federal government came in and effectively reduced the cost of the CapEx and more of that?
Yes.
We did not do a direct scenario on that, but I'd like to draw your attention to the CapEx sensitivity we ran. So as you can see, we ran a case where if you reduce the cost by 10%, so approximately $1 billion, that would reduce the delivered cost of gas by approximately a dollar. And so that's a pretty close relationship. You also do see the converse, so the plus 10% to $12.20. So every $1 billion of CapEx reduced is effectively a dollar off the delivered cost of gas.
So looking at the bottom of the chart, 1198 PT gas supply, is that Point Thompson?
Yes.
Okay, so if the federal government put in, let's say, $4 billion, like a grant, that would shift to about $7.98.
Under the Point Thompson scenario, yes.
In South Central.
In South Central.
Which is about equivalent to what we're paying now at $8.50.
Yes.
Okay. I do this for the man on the street, right? Keep it simple. But this is excellent. Any other questions? There's a lot in this slide. Okay. Representative Sadler?
I'm not sure I understand the second.
Go to the mic, Dan.
Price of gas, I see that, the lows, highs. Is this a cumulative thing? We're talking $10.90 per million cubic feet. And I'm not quite sure if this totals up. Not quite sure what conclusion to draw from the entirety of the right side of the slide.
So there's no totaling up. We isolated each individual item and showed the impact of changing that. So when we, for example, added the 10% on the CapEx sensitivity, all the other factors were held back at their base case. So this analysis, or the chart that we showed, is just the impact and the individual impact of those items themselves. So it's not a cumulative effect. Now, if you did all the cumulative effects of a lower debt ratio or 80-20, a lower federal income, a lower return, a lower cost of gas, less price, that would have a cumulative effect and lower the price even more. We did not conduct that analysis. This was a sensitivity on the key inputs.
Okay.
Threw me off at the columns, misaligned at return on equity.
Yeah. Okay, thank you, Costa. Let's continue.
The other piece of analysis we're doing was comparing the cost of importing LNG. To do this, we broke down the cost into four main components. The cost of the LNG itself, the cost of the molecule, the cost of getting the molecule to Anchorage, the cost of regassing that, so turning it from a liquid back to a usable gas, and then the onshore gas reception, so connecting to the network. So taking a step through each of these, we'll start with the gas price that we're showing on slide 15. What we're showing in that chart is the two likely, or what we consider the most likely contractual situations for buying a gas molecule. The first is what's called a JKM marker. That's a Japan-Korea gas price, so destination. So it's the price of gas destination delivered into Japan. And that's shown in that red line on the chart on the right-hand side. The next is an oil-linked contract, and that's shown in that more steadier oil-linked price that we're showing on the chart as well in the brown-orange color, red, excuse my color blindness. What we are seeing in the market is the sellers of LNG are preferring to sell by the JKM marker. There are still some long-term oil contracts, but they're becoming less and less common, and everyone is linking to that JKM price. What we show on the bottom in the table on the right-hand side is the average price of JKM for the next, from 2031 to 2050, is approximately $11. While the oil link price is $9.64. So those will act as the two end members of our range of price.
So Costa, real quick, since we're talking about Japan, where does Japan get their LNG from currently? Like, what countries do they import from? Oh, geez, your next slide. Okay.
Thank you for setting me up for my
Representative McCabe, though. All right. Sorry about that.
Not a problem. So on slide 16.
Teacher's pet here.
Is the shipping costs. Now, the world map that we have on the left-hand side is what we've highlighted is potential locations where Alaska could potentially buy its gas from. They're also the same locations that supply the North Asia market. So if you start West Coast Canada, then we looked at West Coast Mexico and East Coast Australia. Now, Japan do get LNG from other places, including West Coast Australia, which is even further, parts of Papua New Guinea and the rest of Southeast Asia for it. So to work out the shipping cost, what you'd have to do and what we have done is you take the cost in Japan and then what's the cost of shipping that from, let's say, Australia, which is 88 cents. So moving a molecule from Australia to Japan is 88 cents. So you take that off the JKM price, but then you have to add in, well, what's the cost of shipping from the US, from Australia to Alaska? That's $2.21. So the difference between that is an additional cost over and above the JKM of $1.22. Now, if you were able to source and get a contract, an offtake agreement from Mexico directly on the West Coast, that shipping differential, as we're calling it, is about zero. So you would get the JKM price. And Mexico, and if you were to get it from Canada, it's negative. So you'd actually reduce the JKM price by approximately 43 cents.
I'm just thinking, okay, Representative McCabe.
We've got the gas from Alaska. I mean, if we sent, you know, I listened to a talk by Rahm Emanuel several years ago talking about the difference in shipping times from the Port of Alaska, Port McKenzie, wherever, right here in Alaska, to Japan, Singapore, South Korea, or Indo-Pacific allies, versus coming from Australia. So it's about half, I think 7 days from us and 14 days from the east coast of Australia, a little bit more from the west coast. You're going through the tropical convergence zone and the islands and stuff, and midway in between from Mexico and even Vancouver or Prince Rupert is a couple days more. So what would the cost be in JKM shipping out of Alaska?
We have done the analysis for that. We actually did it in 2016 and redid that analysis when we worked with a GDC in 2021-22. I don't have the number off the top of my head, but the framework of what you said, and it's one of the competitive advantages of Alaska LNG, is being closer to the end market, which does reduce your shipping cost.
So,
but I don't know what that number is off the top of my head. We can get back to you.
Be great. Follow up.
Oh, I'm sorry. Representative McCabe, I was looking at Sadler.
Yeah, so you mentioned that Canada, so coming out of British Columbia, or maybe that's Prince Rupert. I can't tell where the arrow goes right there. Maybe it's that pipeline that we asked the question about earlier. You said that's a negative number.
Yes, shipping-wise, yes.
So likely Alaska would be the same because it's actually 2 days shorter coming from Anchorage, so it would likely be negative?
If you were – now, there's issues around the Jones Act,
sure,
and other restrictions, which is why we haven't included any LNG shipped from the U.S. to Alaska in our analysis because the Jones Act prevents that. It would, based on the analysis, it is a shorter distance and it's shorter. So you would expect, if you could, despite regulatory hurdles to that, it would reduce the JKM price. Yes, okay. In a similar method to Canada.
Thanks,
Representative Sadler.
After some analysis, I think what this slide says is it's cheaper to get gas from places that are closer to Alaska. After some detailed analysis, which it's a pretty simple concept.
Yes.
Also, it says. This is all adjustments. What is the default from which we're making adjustments?
So the default, it's all adjusted from the JKM price.
Sorry, say again?
It's adjusted from the JKM price. So if you're paying the JKM Japan, what's the effective cost of shipping, the netted back on that? Gotcha. What we are seeing in the LNG market is a lot of the previous contracts were from point to point. So shipping from Australia to Japan from project specific. What we are seeing is that people are buying from companies' portfolios, and the oil companies like the Shells of the world and the BPs of the world move LNG not necessarily from point A to B, but it's into their portfolio, and they fill the need as they see.
So I have two quick questions. It's my understanding that the Biden administration right now has a ban on exporting LNG from the United States. Is that in place right now, correct? No.
Not.
It was, though.
It's a pause on permitting for new LNG projects.
Okay. And then getting back to my previous question, how much, so I'll phrase it slightly different, how much of Japan's imported LNG comes from Russia? Half of it? Three quarters?
Unfortunately, I do not have that information.
Or just, okay, all right. Sorry for the left field questions.
Not a problem.
All right, let's continue then. Thank you, Custom.
The next part of the analysis from getting the molecule into Anchorage is the FSRU. So it's a floating storage regas unit. Wood Mackenzie tracks all of them around the world, and similar to the analysis we did in the pipeline, we looked at a data set of 48 FSRUs around the world. What our table shows is the capacity of the nominal capacity of an FSRU and the cost of leasing that FSRU. What we do see when you look at the FSRUs globally, they operate at a utilization typically of 40 to 45%. And using that South Central demand number of approximately 150 MMCFD per day, you're looking at needing an FSRU of around 350 to 400 MMCFD a day of nominal capacity, which relates to and looks at the cost of regas of between $1 to $1.50 per MMBTU. That is just the vessel.
So if I can maybe boil this down a little bit for our, again, like I said, the man on the street, the floating storage regasification units, if we have a lot of gas storage in Cook Inlet, a lot of gas storage capacity, we could bring in an FSRU and it could offload into our reservoirs.
Potentially.
Okay? That'd be the smartest way to do it. Put all that, regasify it, put it into our storage reservoirs, and then save it for the winter. That, to me, that would be kind of what would happen.
Potentially. They also have some storage on board as well, just to mitigate and manage
right.
flow out. But
right.
Yes.
Okay. Representative
Sam. Chair, to understand the slide, the 45 or 40% low utilization, does that mean the fleet is only used 40% of the fleet or only 40% of the capacity? And why is that important to this project?
Through the chair, the 40 to 45% is the utilization of each individual unit.
What does that mean?
So you have a nominal capacity of, I'll make the numbers easy, of let's say you have a nominal capacity of 100 MMCFD per day. What you do see is they will only run 40 to 45%, 40 to 45 MMCFD per day through that unit on average over a whole year. Now, the reason you have that lower utilization over the whole year is a lot of the issues relating to storage and winter demand. Gas demand tends not to be stable in most locations around the world on a yearly basis. The demand goes up and down, so the facilities need to be spec'd. So the capacity could take a maximum input of higher, but on average, you see a 40 to 45% utilization of the capacity of that unit on an annual basis.
So a follow-up.
Yeah, a follow-up.
Is they are inherently inefficient, unless you can find one that is sized exactly to what your market needs and your infrastructure can adopt. I assume that the closer the correlation, the less inefficiency, the lower per unit price for us.
Through the chair, yes, the closer they're spec and the less variability in your demand would mean you don't need to have excess capacity to meet changes in demand.
Okay. And I guess the implication of that inefficiency, why is that important to list there? Why is that important for us to know?
That was important to know to understand the size of the unit you will potentially need to import LNG, because the size of the unit has a direct relationship to the cost of it. The bigger the unit, actually, the lower the cost on a per unit basis. So that's why if you have a look at the chart we have there, we've used and assumed a regas cost of $1 to $1.50, which puts the unit in that $4.80 to $4.10 range of cost. As you can see, the smaller the unit, the actual per unit cost of the regas goes up.
And so, one more effect. So does that mean we have to, in order to have between $4.10 and $4.80, we have to have one that's between, you know, twice that size or a little bit more than twice that size?
If you were to import that gas, we've assumed on the, going back to the earlier slides, the base demand, that base load demand of South Central demand of what is essentially existing is approximately 150 MMCFD. That's why you need a unit of around 350 to 400 MMCFD.
So in conclusion, if we buy a load of LNG on a FSRU for $15 an MCF or MMBTU, am I getting ahead of you again?
I'm two slides ahead of you.
But I got to add this cost to that. Okay.
Yes. You need to add this cost to the cost of the molecule.
Okay, please continue.
No worries. I'll try and be quicker so you don't get ahead of me. So the fourth cost is the onshore reception. So the cost that we've talked about is the gas cost, the shipping cost, the regas cost. That gets the molecule to the end of the FSRU. But then you do need to connect it to the network. And that connection involves building a jetty or quay, having an offloading facility, and then connecting to the existing network. When you look at this additional CapEx and where we've looked at around the world for those 48 FSRUs that we have in our database, we see the CapEx range is really quite large, somewhere between $50 to up to $500 million to build the quay and have that onshore reception. Now, this is also, that range of cost is also very uncertain because it does depend very heavily on the meta-ocean conditions, where the site is, what's existing infrastructure there. As of the writing of this report, there was no site that we could point to or name or understand. We left this cost and these estimates undetermined. So any of the costs that we see from an LNG on the next slide when we build it up, we actually do not include the onshore connection cost of that somewhere between $50 to $500 million.
Okay, thank you.
So, Chair, going to your earlier question, sorry I wasn't quick enough, on slide 19, on the left-hand slide, bringing all together those costs, what we see is the LNG price. And we've got that low range of the oil link price at $9.60, that higher range at the JKM price of $11. The next is shipping, that minus 40 cents if you're coming from Mexico, the plus $1.20 if you're coming from Australia. Then the regas of $1 to $1.50. What that means, if you move over to the chart on the right-hand side, is you have a cost of importing LNG of between $10.20 and $13.72, and that's without that onshore reception area, which should increase the cost. Now, what we're showing on the other side of this chart are the four prices that we did in the sensitivity analysis and the base case that we did for the pipe gas. So that $12.80 for the base load, the Woodmac case of $11.20 to the $8.97 to the $2.32 for Alaska. What we also do see is an increased throughput in LNG. So if you have more gas demand and you're moving more LNG through your system, it does not have the same impact on price because the molecule price stays the same. You don't get that economies of scale of the throughput to help bring down a tariff rate that you do in the pipeline situation.
Okay, very interesting slide. Any questions? Okay, thank you for that, Costa. I appreciate it.
No worries. Hopefully I answer your questions before you ask them now. The last piece of analysis we undertook was understanding the socioeconomic benefits of Alaska LNG Phase 1 pipeline. And we looked at this in four components. Again, first was the CapEx during the construction and what impact that would have on the economy and jobs, both direct jobs. We looked at the socioeconomic impact of its operating over a lifetime. So what's the expenditure spend in state, the increased government revenue, direct job creation during that phase. We then looked at the induced and indirect benefits. So what's the impact of an extra dollar going into the economy? What does that mean? What do the jobs mean? And then we did look at the potential savings versus an LNG situation and what that could mean to Alaska. Now, this slide's slightly busy. Let me take a sec to explain it. Hopefully, I can do it so no more questions are asked. What we're showing on the left-hand side of that chart, we've got two bar charts. The left-hand chart is the economic impact that we would forecast or estimated to happen if an LNG import happens. So this is the capex of building the quay, building the connections, et cetera, et cetera. Now, a lot of the costs in the LNG situation occur outside of Alaska. So the economic impact goes up to about $1.4 billion. On the right-hand side of that right-hand chart, we have the economic impact of phase one of the LNG. So what you do see is economic impact of an increase of $10.3 billion to the Alaska economy with a potential savings of almost $6.2 billion on cost to the gas cost to the consumer.
So $6.2 billion divided by 700,000 people,
using a sort of a $5.6 billion total saving number, somewhere around that $6 billion, it's about $291 to $300 per year per Alaskan affected by the gas price who are buying gas from here.
Okay. Representative McCabe.
Thanks. So a question that I know my constituents are intensely interested in. All of this on this slide doesn't include any kind of government tax credits such as 45Q for any kind of sequestration or anything else. That's a total separate deal than you're talking about right here, correct?
Through the chair, yes, correct. It does not include anything else.
Thanks.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, through the chair. Economic impact, is that revenue to the state? Is that a net impact of deleterious versus beneficial? Please explain the term economic impact.
Through the chair. So the economic impact is what's described, and it's a common term, is the gross value added. So it's what you could expect to happen if you invest in the company and the impact on the overall GDP of the economy of the state of Alaska.
The enhancement of the state gross state product.
Yes.
Which is different from economic impact, which would take negative, impact. Well, okay.
Okay, please continue, Costa.
On slide 22, we're showing the jobs impact of both or the additional jobs that either option could occur. Well, now we've split this up between the construction and the operation phases. So on the left-hand side, we start with the construction phase, and we're showing the LNG imports and the Alaska LNG phase one. The dark blue represents the direct jobs, so the people actually working on these projects. The light blue are the induced jobs and indirect jobs. What we show as well is for the imported LNG case, we estimate or forecast 560 jobs for 3 years will be the impact of the construction of the LNG facility. Under the Alaska LNG phase one, that number is over 2,000 jobs or 2,200 jobs for 5 years. So it's 2,200 jobs for 5 years. On an operational side, you see that same impact where operating the assets for 40 years. You have 250 jobs for 40 years on the LNG impact with over 1,100 jobs for the Alaska pipeline.
And I would add, Costa, that you also would have a lot of jobs created by the increased activity for gas exploration and production all over the state. Now that you don't have stranded gas anymore, now that you have a market for gas, you would have drilling activity for gas, which creates a whole other industry.
Yes, and I would also like to point out...
I hope I'm not ahead on another slide.
No, you aren't. I would also like to point out that these jobs are only directly related to the pipeline and the LNG facility. So going back, the pipeline and importing the LNG. So if we go back to the earlier slides of an increased industrial activity that we saw under some of the other cases, these job numbers do not account for that increased level of activity.
Okay. Representative Dybert has a question on slide 8, which is...
Hi, thanks through the chair.
Going back a ways, sorry. Okay, Representative Dybert, please proceed with your question on slide 8.
Okay, sorry, I didn't mean to, I thought we had time at the end, but I'll go ahead with my question. On slide 8, another question, thank you through the chair, on Fairbanks. The report on the very bottom of the slide, it says, examining the economic viability, that Fairbanks will have 90% of households connected to natural gas by 2034. And my question is that number based on accurate estimates from Interior Gas Utility or any other entity? And does that include, like, our military bases, like Fort Wainwright, Eielson, and our utility, GVA, who use it exclusively? Thank you. Through the chair.
Through the chair, that assumption is a three-year transition from 31 to 33. And it's a simplistic assumption that if you take the current needs for heating and power that we see that are used for the truck LNG, the fuel oil, the wood, and you assume 90% of that is converted to gas, that's what that demand line is.
Okay, Representative Dybert, does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, thank you.
Okay, thank you, Representative Dybert. Okay, Costa, please continue. I think we're doing pretty good on time, but we'll just keep pushing. Thank you.
Thank you. So on slide 23, we've talked about the direct economic and the socioeconomic benefits. Specifically to Fairbanks, what you could potentially see of getting gas piped through them is you could see a further benefits, which would be cleaner air, the removal of the non-attainment, EPA's non-attainment, and access and grants to investment because of that non-attainment. Now, we have also done, on slide 24, a quick comparison compared to what their energy costs are today for Fairbanks to what they will be moving forward. So on the left-hand side, you see the cost of trucked LNG, of fuel oil, of $19.60 and $27.90 versus that base load of $12.80. Again, this does not include the spur cost, which... Frank mentioned was approximately 80 cents would need to be added on top of these for Fairbanks. But as you can see, there is considerable savings in the cost of fuel by switching from fuel oil or truck LNG to a gas service from the gas pipeline.
So I really don't want to get too augured in, but I want to help Fairbanks and I want to help us all understand. If I live in Fairbanks right now, my house, the typical house in Fairbanks, is heated with fuel oil or electric. And maybe somebody that's more familiar with Fairbanks can help me. But if you're going to switch to natural gas, you have to completely, lay pipelines, gathering lines, distribution lines, and then they'd have to change out their furnaces and their homes. And I don't know if it's as easy as we might think to just flip a switch and every house in Fairbanks gets to go on gas, even though it'd be great, right? Can somebody explain that to me, how that would work? And I know Representative Dybert might answer that question. I don't want to get sidetracked, but go ahead, Costa.
The trucked LNG, the pipe gas would be a direct replacement for that. The fuel gas, I can't comment on.
Okay. Representative Dybert, can you help us understand how Fairbanks would switch to gas just kind of magically to your house?
Yeah. Thank you, through the chair. It's happening right now. We have homes that are switching to gas. In different parts of our town and downtown Fairbanks. So it is happening slowly. Moving forward, like the infrastructure costs, one of my question is, would more infrastructure be needed in Fairbanks that included like a possible pressure reducing station that would be included in the total capital cost for this to happen. Thank you, through the chair.
Okay, maybe we'll get to that in the last presentation. Sorry to sidetrack us. Representative McCabe.
Yeah, thanks, Chair McCabe. So there is there's recent examples of that. This little city in my district converted half of their city to natural gas.
Okay.
Very recently, last couple of years, and the residents are ecstatic over the, and I'm sure it cost them money to change their oil-fired boiler over to a natural gas-fired boiler, but they are over the moon in the savings that they had, like a tenth of, I mean, it's amazing just to listen to them. So I think the initial outlay might be a lot for the residents, and maybe there would be credits or government credits, especially with the non-attainment stuff that Fairbanks is going through. They already got a whole bunch of credits for changing over wood stoves to a proficient wood stove. So.
Okay, thank you, Representative McCabe. Representative Sadler.
I think part of the challenge is that the gentleman here is presenting the results of a study and laying out the study design and so forth, the assumptions that have been made, and being solution people and problem solvers, we're leaping ahead to how to implement that analysis on our individual situations and statewide solutions. I think the analysis that we're being presented is going to inform those decisions as we continue this work. But again, I applaud us for let's get to the solution. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. Please continue, Costa.
And this is my last slide, so there'll be no more preempting from the chair. Just to summarize, so to build the gas pipeline, to supply the gas, would cost on a pipeline of $10.8 billion. We have seen the Cook Inlet gas supply has been declining, and the volumes that have been discovered have not been able to arrest that decline. We see a supply gap opening up. So if gas is to fill that need, you need about 2.3 TCF more gas to be discovered. So to meet that, we've analysed two potential options, the LNG imports and the natural gas pipeline supply. Now, the delivered cost of gas from the pipeline is from as low as $2.23 to $12.80, while the delivered cost of gas from the LNG imports is $10.20 at the very lowest to $13.70. You then see the pipeline has greater direct, indirect and induced benefits of $10.3 billion to a maximum of 1.4. Nearly four times as many jobs are created, of 2,270 jobs during construction versus 580. The first time to gas of a pipeline we've assumed is 2031, while LNG imports is 3 to 4 years post FID, depending on, and that's assuming all permitting goes smoothly over that time. So what you also do see under the pipe gas, which we've shown and we're just talking about, is that potential other upsides to a pipeline from connecting Fairbanks to gas network, which wouldn't have occurred or we've assumed will not occur under an LNG import situation. And lastly, there does reduce the risk to a full Alaska LNG project as the pipeline will be built before the facilities themselves. So that was my last slide. Thank you for today.
Okay, thank you very much, Costa and Akita. We so much appreciate your presentation. Representative Sadler has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate your indulgence. This is not really a question kind of so much as some of my thoughts on the issue. You have made an analysis. You've got a situation and supply and so forth. You've laid it out. And the conclusion I think you're leading us to is clearly that the per unit cost and the impacts, the benefits to Alaskan is much greater with the phase one of the AKLNG project. And this is great as far as it goes, but it is one element of the larger equation. My metaphor I'm going to speak is buying a new car provides you lower maintenance costs, higher gas mileage, better resale value, more comfort, et cetera, local jobs. Used cars, inefficient, old, clunky, you look ugly. But there's the initial entry cost. It costs a lot of money to build phase one. FSRUs, importing LNG, may be disadvantageous on a per unit basis and for the state economy, but it's a lower hurdle cost, is the lower nut. And that's the larger question. The benefits are clear as long as we have the cash for the table. And the question for us is, where do we get the money to invest to avail ourselves of these increased efficiencies and benefits of the Phase 1 AKLNG project? That's the larger question for us. Thank you.
There was not a question in there. That's a statement, right, Representative?
Statement, not a question.
Okay, Representative McCabe, please.
Again, on this slide 25, this very last slide, I think the benefit to us, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it says direct, indirect, and GVA jobs, 2,271 jobs during build-out, and then another 1,138 in operations where importing is 568 jobs during build-out. One would assume that's the shore, and then only 250 in operation. So if we as a legislature are looking at creating jobs or job creation as part of our sort of mandate, it seemed to me that buying the new car would probably be the better idea.
Through the chair, yes. If more jobs are created under the pipe situation than the imported LNG case. I won't comment on the new car analogy.
We got to keep it simple here. Thanks, Kevin. Okay, Representative Mears.
Thank you, through the chair. I really appreciate the presentation and getting into depth today, especially since there are a lot of assumptions that we talked about. I'd like to get more comfort with some of the assumptions that went into the model. I fully support our market solutions that are good for Alaska. We just need to make sure they're good. I think we've verified imported prices, which is kind of proving out for what's happening between about $12 to $14. We haven't really, I think, discussed in here the timing of this coming on with our actual, you know, production in Cook Inlet. We've been discussing that mostly in this committee in terms of the termination of Hillcorp contracts, but there are other players there, and there is continuing natural gas from there. There are some other assumptions that are kind of big in here. One is the reduction in the property taxes. That was a pretty big line. I think that was something that was brought up last spring as well, and that is very up to negotiations with our, you know, our local boroughs. And we didn't talk about the increased efficiency coming along. We just instituted a green bank program last year for HFC to administer. On the heating end, the vast majority of customers are residential customers. And when they're faced with going up from 9 to 12 to 14 potentially price increase, I believe we'd expect some changes in efficiency that the private sector is going to do. There's more.
You have a question, Representative Mears. We need a question.
So the scope appears to require all of the demand. It requires even going back to some things that have happened in the past that might require a lower cost to be on par with the imported LNG. My big concern here is that if all this risk of this cost is put on Alaskans, if we are not getting to the LNG part, we are locked into this capital project and these costs for the next 40 years. And the only thing that relieves us is getting imports. Have I mischaracterized this?
Through the chair, so just one of the points is we actually have factored in an efficiency, so you can see the decline we have in our demand is an assumed efficiency for the demand. If I did make that clear when I was presenting. The point around the cost locking, we've assumed that you would need a 20-year or 40-year outlook for these prices. But what we have also run is sensitivities on that, and what would it potentially look like if the project life only had 20 years and or 30 years. So what I'm showing on slide 13 here is if the project was only 20 years, so half the life that you're seeing now, it only raises the price of gas from $11.20 to $11.77, so 57 cents per MCF if instead of using a 40-year horizon for the outlook, you use a 20.
Okay, thank you, Costa, very much, and we better move on to our final presentation. Thank you, committee, for your questions. Costa and Akita, thank you for your travel, and we really, really appreciate your presentation and your analysis, and it was extremely informative and wonderful to have you here today. So thank you.
Thank you, Chair.
So next, I'd like to welcome Mr. Frank Richards with the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation and his associates. And Mr. Richards, if you could come forward and have you and Nick state your name and your affiliation and begin your presentation for us. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Frank Richards. I'm the president of the Alaska Gasline Development Corporation.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Nick Shimoniak, Venture Development Manager for AGDC.
Mr. Chairman, I know that we're at the 4 o'clock hour, so I want to quickly go through some of our slides. Again, you heard today from Costa what the concept is for the Alaska LNG project. What this is, as we've talked about previously with this committee, is this is the first phase of the full Alaska LNG project. But it's really just that pipeline portion that would lead from the North Slope, and it would terminate in South Central Alaska in the Mat-Su. That's where it ties into the existing NSTAR delivery system. This project has gone through the regulatory process led by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. We did complete a final environmental impact statement. We've gotten the authorizations from both FERC and Department of Energy for export. The grants that are provided to us on the state and federal lands we now have, and we have conducted a tremendous amount of work on cultural resource to be able to execute without it to the field. So those permits are ready and available for the initial phase of this project. As you heard from the Wood Mackenzie analysis, it shows that pipeline gas is competitive to the imported LNG. And the cost stack on the left-hand side shows that range that they built up from 1020 to 1372 without the cost of onshore reception. That's the cost of building a jetty, loading and docking station for whether it be an FSRU or an LNG import facility, and any onshore regas. So that cost stack, and what's really key for Alaska is how we're different, is as more volumes flow through the pipeline, the cost savings would then be provided to the customers, which would mean Alaskans and the cost savings in their home heating and power bills. The legislature gave us the intent language in the operating budget last year after a good discussion with leadership in the legislature and with the governor. And the direction that we were provided in this intent language was the real reason that we're here today, which was to hear the outcome of that Wood Mackenzie analysis. And so we hope that this report, which shows what we believe is positive economic value or gross value added to the state of Alaska, will allow the legislature to work with us in moving forward to that next phase of the project, which is going to be front-end engineering and design. In order to accomplish and get the pipeline moving forward, this front-end engineering and design, or FEED, is the next logical step. And this is where we will take the work that we have done, we originally did with the producers under the Alaska LNG project when ExxonMobil was leading the work. We did a pre-FEED level of design on the pipeline. We've coupled that with the work that AGDC had done on the in-state line, where we had completed a FEED level of effort for the pipeline. So we have a tremendous base knowledge that we will then need to update, and primarily update the cost estimate, which would then feed into the economics and the cost of delivery to the ultimate consumers here, which is the utilities. We're working with a pipeline operator to be able to take on and execute the FEED, but they will need to have a surety that if the project doesn't go forward, then they would be repaid for their FEED cost up to $150 million. And that's really the concept of the FEED backstop that we've been talking about. While FEED is underway, we'll be looking at entering into those commercial agreements, which would mean that we'd be asking the utilities to supply long-term agreements. Then those agreements would be used in terms of the debt financing, the equity raise, ultimately to go to construction. And the premise that we're going forward with on this phase of the project is always that the private sector will take this project forward. They'll complete the FEED to their level of design criteria. They have their rate of return that they'll build into their economics and see that it is economic to move forward. All the while, we've retained the right, but not the obligation for the state, if it so chooses at final investment decision, to invest up to 25% ownership. So it's not conditioned on the state buying into it. It's actually allowing the state, if it so chooses, and that's going to be a policy call by the legislature and the ministry. So very quickly, FEED is, again, it's a term of art in engineering, specifically in the oil and gas business, where you take the design up to a point where you can actually get price quotes on the design aspects of it, look at long lead time items, look at the cost of some of those major equipment purchases that you need to do, get it ready for actually going out to contract with an engineering procurement and construction contractor, in this case contractors, who have four different spreads within the state of Alaska, and then have that cost estimate to be able to take a final investment decision. So the cost of that next phase, we've estimated up to $50 million. And that range of up to $50 million is that there's going to be a cost to actually have the engineering completed. There will be owner's oversight by a pipeline company to be able to do that. And then a 20% contingency built into that level of effort as well. So it's not that $50 million would ultimately be spent. It's up to $50 million. And the stakeholders for this initial phase is really Alaskans. And that's why we brought this concept forward to the legislature and to the administration, is that we have a project. We are advancing the commercial discussions to move forward with the full Alaska LNG project. But at the same time, if we can advance the initial phase or the pipeline portion of the project, then it will allow for natural gas resources from Alaska's North Slope to be used by Alaskans for a very long time. And that was really the premise that we started this conversation on, was the ability for the work efforts that have been funded by the legislature, that have been conducted, AGDC and others, to be put to use to meet the supply issues that we are facing in Cook Inlet. It also provides, again, the opportunity for us to be able to continue those discussions for the larger project, the LNG export project. And I will tell you, from the conversations that we have had, again, with the Asian countries, when we talk about this concept of building the pipeline first, it significantly reduces the risk in their eyes, and it increases the likelihood of their participation in long-term contracts by LNG from the export project. Now, in terms of supply, you heard, and part of the questions today was about, again, Great Bear. We have signed a gas sale precedent agreement with Great Bear. That's for up to 500 million standard cubic feet a day. And so as you heard from Wood Mackenzie, their analysis is looking at 150 million standard cubic feet a day. So that's about over two and a half times the amount of gas Great Bear has committed to selling into the project for a price of less than a dollar per million BTU. And that gas is, again, coming off of that prospect that doesn't require removal of CO2 to meet the pipeline quality spec we have in the state of Alaska. So that is very key. Don't have that high cost of removing the CO2 or other constituents. But in order to go forward with financing, we need to make sure that we have backup supplies. And that's why we're continuing engagement with the producers on the North Slope, from the Prudhoe Bay unit to the Point Thompson unit into the satellite fields, to make sure that there's enough supply, we would have precedent agreements in place to be able to meet the needs of South Central Alaska.
Okay, Representative McCabe has a question.
So what about Canada? What about Northwest Territories, the Mackenzie gas that's stranded and has been in planning as long as our pipeline has, like four decades, and they're currently just sitting there. There's a Native corporation that's running some plans, or the First Nations, but what if we built a pipeline across the top? I know we can't pipeline over to Canada, but nothing says they can't pipeline over to us. Would they be a possibility for a supplier?
Through the chair, Representative McCabe, for this initial phase, we've looked at it for Alaskan sources first, because, again, it's the capital cost to be able to get to the gas. Costa may have told you in his analysis, to get from Prudhoe Bay to Point Thompson, 63 miles. And then from Point Thompson across the Mackenzie, let's say an average 125, 200 miles. I'm not sure the actual distance. But that adds cost. And so we want to be able to provide gas at the lowest cost for Alaskans. Ideally, looking to the future, if they wanted a way to take their gas to market, this pipe could provide that.
Yeah, follow-up questions.
And we could say they wanted to build the pipeline over and meet us somewhere, and we could charge them for getting their gas to market or to LNG tankers or that sort of thing?
Correct. There would be a tolling fee running through the system.
Cool.
And a presidential permit, but I think that might be.
I think it's time for our president and their prime minister to say, let's make a deal. Okay.
All right.
Let's continue.
Just to let you know, we have not stopped our efforts in terms of advancing the full Alaska LNG project. We have been on a capital raise in terms of talking to the LNG developers, financiers, countries about the opportunity that we call Alaska LNG. And so that $150 million capital raise is actively ongoing. At the same time, we've talked to folks about the opportunity for a $50 million capital infusion for the backstop for this project, in addition to talking to the legislature for that. So we are continuing to move this forward with investors coming into the project, with the state backing, as you have, of AJDC's operations, but looking ultimately for the private sector to take on this project and move it forward to execution.
So thank you, Mr. Richards. So I guess the obvious question is the $50 million. Can you wait until the next legislature gavels in, I think it's January 21st? And
I don't have any control. The earlier we get the $50 million, the sooner we can start the engineering. I
mean, we have no authority to allocate funds here, but I don't know exactly how to ask that or answer it. That it is an issue, I guess. And if the legislature would have to go into special session to appropriate that money, I guess, between now and January 21st, before the next legislature is sworn in. So I don't know. But anyway, Representative Sadler, question?
Sure. Sir Richards, assuming that the money is found somewhere to either $50 or $150 million to get to a final investment decision to FID, what does that decision look like? I understand you kind of, how do you eat an elephant one bite at a time and don't look at the elephant, you live day by day. But say you do get the money for whatever vehicle mechanism, what is the decision for the state of Alaska? How much money do we have to put forward, lay on the table to actually make the final investment decision?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, if let's just use round numbers, and so we'll talk about a $10 billion project cost. And if the state elected to take on a 25% ownership stake, then that would be about $2.5 billion. Within that, the debt-to-equity ratio that, as you heard from Costa, our economic model shows a 75-25 debt-to-equity ratio. So 25% of $2.5 billion would be a state contribution if the state elected to do that. And then the debt financing would come on top.
Yeah, and I'll just add, Nick Schmoniak for the record, and Frank's been very consistent with this, but I do want to reiterate, that's if the state elects. Under this model and these economics, past the $50 million, whether we secure that from the state or elsewhere, at FID, the expectation is that those funds will be supplied entirely by the private sector and paid back entirely by Alaska rates as well as future industrial users. So there wouldn't necessarily need to be a future ask of funds from the state of Alaska in order to make the economics that Wood Mackenzie just shared with the committee.
So, Representative Mears, let me hold you just for a second. I believe you told me recently, Mr. Richards, that the pipeline, the AK LNG project at full capacity would spin off $600 to $700 million a year to the Alaska State Treasury.
Mr. Chairman, you're referring to there was actually a Department of Revenue analysis looking
okay.
at the benefits to the state of Alaska from royalty production, corporate tax, et cetera.
Okay.
In that $600 to $700 million range for the full Alaska LNG project.
So, okay, what would we see from the phase one, just the in-state use? How much would go to the Treasury? Be something less than that, obviously, right? But
Through the chair, this is Nick Shmoniak. I don't have the number in front of me. That was part of the scope of the WoodMac report. I don't believe it was in the slides they presented today, but in the 50-some-odd page slide pack, I believe there's a slide on the fiscal impacts of the state.
I guess what I was driving at is if the state appropriates $2.5 billion for this project, phase one, how soon would we get that paid back at so much a year? Let's say we get $100 million a year. What is that, $2.5 billion? That's 25 years?
Well, again, if the state elected to pony up for the full equity at $2.5 billion as opposed to 25%.
Yeah.
So let's say if it's 25%, then that's, $675 million? And then it would be the rate that the state would want to receive in that.
Yeah, okay. Not good at finance stuff, but we would get our money back eventually.
Ideally, and so
the production.
And I guess one of the points that again Acosta talked about is when the pipeline is built for phase one, and it's based on the consumption and the demand within the state of Alaska, that opens up the opportunities though also within the state of Alaska for either industrial restart that we've talked about, or new greenfield development, such as ammonia. And then most recently, what the state has seen is a tremendous interest from the owners, developers, power producers for data centers.
Yes.
They would want to consume gas from Alaska Pipeline and in a location where they would have access to the amenities and international airport. And there's lots of available land just to the north and west of us.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Mears, a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair to Mr. Richards, with the intent language, with a positive economic value to the state, I think the consideration for off the rail belt is something we should also be thinking about. Our renewable energy fund project list is $32 million. 90% of that is off the rail belt. And I think that's something that needs to be considered as well. Not all of Alaska is able to benefit from this project. And I know there's potential for having other offtakes, but that's something that we need to be considering as well.
Through the chair, Representative Mears, you're absolutely right. And I would say that the legislature actually considered that when they created Alaska Gasline Development Corporation under House Bill 4 and Senate Bill 138, where they actually created a rural energy fund that will receive revenue from this portion of the state's taxes that would come in, is actually then deposited to the rural energy fund for distribution by the legislature as a way to be able to provide some of the benefits that other communities that have direct access to the pipeline would have the access from the revenue to be able to meet their needs.
Okay, Representative McCabe.
So, Mr. Richards, I have a couple questions, actually, or a question and a statement. So why wouldn't we bond for this? Why wouldn't we do a rate reduction bond or securitize the pipeline over 50 years or however long the life is and bond for it instead of trying to get it out of the state? I mean, would that be a possibility?
Mr. Chairman, that again, that is a policy question that the legislature certainly could make that decision. The option that we're trying to provide is that you have that ability to if the state wants to be an owner participant, you'll have that ability. And how you fund that, it's really that policy call that you all
follow up.
Follow up, Representative McCabe.
When the railroad wants to build a new rail spur or something like that, or a dock in Seward, they go to the legislature with a bill and they say, we want, and I know they're a different corporation, different style of corporation, but they say, we want $60 million to bond for this, and this is how we're going to pay for it, and this is our partners or our anchor tenants or whatever. Why wouldn't AGDC do that?
We could, Mr. Chairman. As we reach that point of final investment decision, it will be a conversation that we'll be looking at the opportunities and be able to present then those opportunities to the legislature. The legislature, by the way, did give AGDC bonding authority. Again, their revenue, there'd be revenue-based bonds, so the revenue coming off the project could pay those bonds back. But again, it didn't come with the full faith and credit of the state. We'll ask have come to get that pledge from the legislature.
And of course, we need the feed to get to that conversation. Right? You need, you know, it's kind of a, that's the order of things. And, but.
Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Follow up, Rep. McCain?
Statement. You're going to hear this from me a lot in the next 2 years. Who's going to pay for this? Is it going to come out of the PFD? Is it going to come out of defined benefits? Is it going to come out of the BSA increase that everybody wants? Who is going to pay for this, and how is it going to affect other programs? Kind of a rhetorical question, not really meant for you, Mr. Richards, but Alaskans need to decide what is more important. Thanks.
Okay, any other questions from the committee? Oh, Representative Dybert, I can always count on Representative Dybert. I got to keep looking up there.
thank you, through the chair. Thank you, Mr. Richards, for the quick presentation today. And I certainly agree that the value of having a pipeline built would be great for our energy costs and our economy. And I look forward to all the jobs that are provided. So thank you. I just want to get on the record, and you might hear this a lot from me too, that any funding allocation should include the Fairbanks spur and the needed infrastructure in the plan, so Fairbanks consumers are not, you know, left behind and, you know, without gas or paying so much to make it unbearable for the average family. Do you see any way to include the Fairbanks spur and Fairbanks infrastructure in the capital expenditure in the contract? Thank you. Thank you to the chair.
Through the chair, Representative Dybert, again, in the feed, this first $50 million, we will provide an update on the cost estimate and the feed level for the lateral to Fairbanks.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Dybert, and thank you, Mr. Richards, for that. So final comments.
Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, I was just hoping to ask Mr. Richards, I'm very pleased to hear all of the presentations today, and I really appreciate everybody's time. Mr. Richards, can you just briefly speak to the permitting side? You had mentioned state and everything that you needed to get was in place. What feedback has all the permits been gotten from municipalities that would be affected along the route? You know, first and foremost, as the representative for House District 40, making sure that the North Slope Borough has been involved and they're aware of the plans of what could be coming down the pipe.
Through the chair, Representative Baker, thank you for that question. When I presented the list of major permits, those are the strategic permits that really take years to acquire and develop, and that those are what we have in hand. The more tactical permits is what we call the state and the local municipal permits, because the timeline to provide to those agencies and the actual lifespan of those permits are very short. But we have been engaged in conversations. We'll actually be engaged with the North Slope Borough in a work session, hopefully early next month, to be able to talk and provide an update on the project and look towards putting in place a permitting strategy with the boroughs. The governor has asked specifically what are the state permits that are needed for this project, what are the timelines, and are the agencies ready to receive those so that he can see that permits are being considered, the timelines, to make sure that there's no delay or holdup will be executed so that it's ready to go to construction once that FID decision is made.
Thank you, Mr. Richards. Thank you, Mr. Chair. No further questions.
Okay. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Chair. You know, at a certain point in committees like this, questions become statements, and so I'm going to ask a question that's kind of a statement too, but every development project in Alaska seems to sprout or attract, I'll say, nuisance lawsuits or maybe their environmental questions. We saw it with the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. We're seeing it with the Ambler Road. We're seeing it with Donlin Creek, the Donlin Pipeline. Every development project in Alaska attracts the attention of someone who says it should not be built. So as this project would make progress, and this is something you do every day, this is what you're bread and butter every day, do you know of any pending or potential challenges to construction of Alaska of phase one here? The closer we get to reality, the more dangerous those challenges might be. So my question is, are you aware of anybody who says, if this thing gets legged, we're going to stop it?
Through the chair, Representative Pat Stadler, I'm not privy to the strategic planning of folks that want to take that shot at us, but I will say that several have. And so they've gone through the process with the U.S. District Court where they filed, again, their opposition against the FERC permit, against the Department of Energy permit. And I will say those were granted to us under the Trump administration. However, the response that we received from the Department of Justice, as well as the Department of Energy and within the Department of Interior, was always supportive. And they came out defending the authorizations that they provided. So that was very good, certainly in the U.S. District Court in D.C. So we've gotten those. We're waiting for the final decision on the Department of Energy most recent claim. But I think that we're in really good shape for that. The one case that is in state court was filed by our Children's Trust against the state of Alaska, AGDC, and myself.
Follow-up, Sam?
Having observed various gas line proposals over the years and some developments, positive and negative, I know that there has been a federal loan guarantee of it, which was originally $18 billion for a much earlier iteration of a gas pipeline. Could you just please kind of, for our reminding of this public, what is the status of that? Is that still stand? Are there any other federal loan guarantees? What financial assistance might we expect from the federal government based on what we know now and not so much what we speculate in the future, but do that too?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, again, that what he's referring to is the loan guarantees that were put in place under the Alaska Natural Gas Pipeline Act 2004 by Senator Stevens. At the time, it was valued at $18 billion. Meaning a loan guarantee with the full faith and credit of the United States backing the developers of what was going to be the Alaska Natural Gas Pipeline. That included an inflation factor. So since 2004, that number has been growing by the CPI. So now that number is now approximately $31, $32 billion of loan guarantees. Most recent action by Congress was to allow for the eligibility of the Alaska LNG project to be eligible for those loan guarantees. So those are there. What we have run into is that within the Department of Energy, specifically in the Loan Program Office, they need to write regulations to be able to execute those loan guarantees. And so that's why we're working with our congressional delegation to get an appropriation necessary for the Department of Energy staff to write those regulations. Both Senator Sullivan and Senator Murkowski are actively engaged in this conversation, and so we're hopeful that that will be the next step. Once those loan guarantees will come into play, then that provides then to the ultimate developers the opportunity to utilize that full faith and credit of the federal government. And in the slide pack that Costa actually showed, that as one of the sensitivities. So it took the debt finance rate from 6.25 down to a 5 or below. Goldman Sachs has actually been more bullish on it, saying it'll likely reduce the percentage rate by up to 2%. So you can go from 6.25 to 4.25%. That reduction in debt financing will mean lower cost gas for Alaskans. So that's a major positive.
Well, so it's been 20 years and they haven't finished regulations yet for how to...
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, the federal government works in mysterious ways.
Works.
Okay, I'm going to close it then. Final comments. I think that it's also very important to point out that at the present time, just using round numbers, Alaska state government is currently funded 60% from savings, about 40% from natural resource production, which is primarily oil production from the slope. And now with the development of Pika and Willow, we will see that number go in a better direction. But my feeling is that any projects that contribute to the state treasury and the permanent fund and the permanent fund dividend really should be seriously considered by the legislature, because We really need to get off of using our savings to fund our government. There's going to be a lot of demands for defined benefits, for increased funding through the BSA for education, and we need all the revenue sources we can put together that does not involve taxing Alaskans when we have so much resources, so many natural resources to use to fund our government. That's my position. That's my opinion, and I guess I'm using that as a final comment. But thank you very much, Mr. Richards, Nick, and all the presenters today. I think it was very informative. We appreciate the travel that the gentleman made to be here. And we may have another hearing possibly in early December or January, possibly to look at some other options and to get some other updates from some important players in this whole energy situation. So with that, I'd like to close. I want to thank the speaker for being here. I'm just so glad to see you there. And I want to thank Representative Mears, Representative Sadler, Representative Rauscher, McCabe, right? Representative Coulomb for being here with us today. Thank you, Representative Dibert. It's great to see you. And I will now adjourn us at 4:31. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Bye.